This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yes, that's right, folks. We are back after last week's giant-sized excursion. The hard-traveling fanboys are back to normal here in the L-shaped studio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in Hoholoon Plaza. Nick, how are you doing on this fine night? Nick Duke, by the way, my co-host. I'm Greg Phillips. Everybody knows that by this point.
Oh, I'm doing okay. I'm glad to see that we survived the experience of last week, and I'm glad to see that our listeners did as well, those of them that have decided to actually return after that.
Yes, it's been a long week for me as well, Nick. I've pretty much been comatose for the last 7 days, and recovery from our show. And I understand that you actually, after our show, strutted your ass all the way to Gunnersville and back, right?
Well, I did, and then, you know, after I got back, I was feeling kind of sluggish, Greg. Been having a tough time getting back into the swing of things after all that, and I decided to do what needed to be done. That's, of course, I got up and I did the muscle man dance.
You hitched up your pants and did the muscle man dance. I think we're all doing the muscle man dance this morning or this evening, whenever we're recording.
Whatever day or time of day this is.
This is exactly. All of us can do the muscle man dance. And you know, it gave me hope because I don't want to be like the pig over there that's just stuffing his face and just fat like I am now, you know? I feel like if we force each other to do the muscle man dance, we can get into the kind of shape that we want to be in.
Maybe. I doubt it, but maybe.
Probably not. But we are alive and well, and we are kicking off. Stop us if you've heard this one before, folks. We're kicking off another theme month here at the Hard Traveling Studios. Mm-hmm. Boy, I'm excited for this one, Nick. You know, we did Avengers month. We did Shazam month. We did Captain Marvel month. Mm-hmm. Let's just keep the ball rolling, shall we?
We shall, until we finally come up with a new idea for whatever is going to replace Hard Travelers for Hire on the schedule. So yes, Mr. Manager, we will continue to do theme months until we decide not to.
And in fitting with our synergistic approach to pop culture in general, this month is, of course, the big comic book movie release is going to be X-Men Dark Phoenix, or just Dark Phoenix, I guess it's being called. And to coincide with that, we are instituting our first ever X-Men month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Now, while the Avengers kind of dominate pop culture now in our discussion of comic book teams and the Marvel Universe in particular, historically, at least over the last 30 or 40 years, the X-Men have dominated pop culture up until the last decade. It's been the X-Men's world, and everybody else is just living in it. And we're going to dedicate this month to Marvel's Merry Band of Mutants. We're going to look at a comic book. We're going to look at an older movie from from our college days, actually. We're going to look at...
From your college days, sir. I'll have you know that movie was released before I ever enrolled in college.
We're going to look at the brand new movie, Dark Phoenix. We're going to have a chance to check that out next week on the show and talk about that one. And to kick things off today, we are going to unveil a very special and a little bit different version of Countdown. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you've listened to our old episodes in the archives here at Place to Be Nation Pop, the only place to be in your pop culture world, you will have heard that usually our Countdown shows involve us counting from 5 to 1 our favorite or least favorite things in a certain topic. Well, this time around, we're approaching the X-Men, the Fox Studios X-Men movies. And to do this, we decided there are so many of these movies that rather than just do a top five, We thought a more fun exercise would be to unveil our complete X-Men movie rankings. We just did this, of course, with the MCU last week here on Hard Traveling Fanboys. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to take time to explain and reveal our definitive X-Men movie rankings. Nick, this was a topic we kind of hammered out over the weekend, and I think this is the right approach to take with this particular subject.
Yeah, we discussed doing our top five, you know, like we normally do, but I feel like our top fives would have been pretty much the same movies, just in maybe a slightly different order. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, why not then have a little bit, make the debate a little bit more interesting and move the debate, you know, we're not going to really discuss the movies in detail as like we normally do. Normally, like, you know, last month when we did Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes episodes, we kind of broke down the episode of each and why we loved the plot of those. This time we're kind of focusing more on why these movies rank where they do, you know, more so than anything else. So that's where we are. We're going to go 11 to 1. We're going to talk about the highs and lows of Fox's X-Men output over the years. And we'll see where, you know, where we fall compared to you. Of course, we would love to hear your list and just that feedback to Greg P. or Nick D. at placetobenation.com, on Twitter at gphillips8652, on at nickduke87, the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, all the places you can reach out and send us your 1 to 11 X-Men rankings. And I think we'll probably update these next week when we bring you our very special review of Dark Phoenix, which we are going to go see in an undisclosed location over the weekend. But all that being said, I guess the best thing to do would be to go ahead and get this party started, and I'll kick it off with my number 11. And Greg, I don't know how you approach this, but I kind of looked at the race to the bottom as really a two-horse race. There were two candidates in my mind that stood out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, this may be the first somewhat controversial selection. I think I'm going against common sentiment here, because my number 11, I'm going to go with X-Men Origins Wolverine. And you know, it's really interesting that I'm going with this one here, because honestly, the performances probably are by and large better in this film than what finishes in my number 10 slot. The problem is the plot is an unmitigated disaster. And it's an unmitigated disaster in a movie that should have been so simple to do. You don't need to do Wolverine's crappy 1840s, you know, small child origin. You don't need to do the stupid he and Sabretooth are brothers thing. You don't need to do half the dumb shit they wind up doing in this movie. You certainly don't need to sew Deadpool's mouth shut and cut literal slots around his eyes and give him the powers of every mutant. It just so much unnecessary shit that happens in the course of this movie. The CGI in particular is an absolute disaster. The action sequences are largely uninventive, which is a real disappointment for a Wolverine movie, because that was the one thing I was looking forward to, as I thought, after what we just got next to, at the very least, the Wolverine stuff in this movie should be good. And honestly, I think part of the reason is just that level of expectation. I don't believe there's an excuse to make a bad Wolverine movie. I can kind of understand cut that leaked online and watched it and immediately was telling everybody, yes, there are things they can fix, but the problems with this movie are not fixable. It was an instantaneous bit of hatred on my part, and it's never really subsided all these years later. So X-Men Origins Wolverine is my dead last number 11 movie.
You mean you didn't like Taylor Kitsch's Gambit?
Oh my God, don't even get me started.
You mean you didn't like shoehorning Cyclops into Wolverine's origin movie?
You mean I didn't like whoever the hell Will.i.am was playing?
You didn't like Buffalo Blob?
No, I was about to say, well, I did like Buffalo Blob, though. Buffalo Blob was good.
Hey, Logan. Could you bring it to me? okay, so this was a real hard choice for me, Nick, because I had to try to separate out the quality of the movie from the level of disappointment. Because, as you mentioned, you saw the movie before we went to go see it. And so my expectations for X-Men Origins Wolverine had already been lowered. If this were a list of the most disappointing movie that I've seen in my life, I think to this day, the number 10 movie might still hold that spot, believe it or not, Nick.
Ooh, over Green Lantern. That's interesting.
Possibly. It's a two-horse race between those two. You have to understand the level of excitement I had for the number 10 movie. But ultimately, I went with the same movie that you did, X-Men Origins Wolverine. I feel like objectively it is the worst movie in the X-Men franchise. It, of course, was directed by Gavin Hood, somewhat of a troubled production, somewhat of a muddled script, misuses of some outstanding actors.
Creepy pedophile Charles Xavier coming out of the woods to usher all the kids into his helicopter near the end.
Yep, absolutely. Deadpool, of course, everyone at this point knows the misuse of Ryan Reynolds and Deadpool. He's great in the beginning of this movie, and then they turn him into something that is so unlike the character of Deadpool, I don't even know what they were going for. One of the worst closing action sequences you'll ever see in your life that includes a Deadpool that has Cyclops' optic blasts and Wolverine's claws and healing factor that looks like Baraka from the Mortal Kombat games. Mm-hmm. This movie misses in so many levels. And we've actually watched this movie for the show before, and the things that always stand out is there are good things in this movie.
Yes.
Pretty much, I like the first half of this movie. I think it's good. It tells a good story. The acting is outstanding from your two leads, who are Hugh Jackman as Wolverine and Liev Schreiber as Sabretooth, who I think is outstanding. Liev Schreiber is a great Sabretooth. Hugh Jackman is the definitive Wolverine, one of the greatest superhero actors of our generation or any. The problem is they're squandered in this movie, because these great performances that you get from these two great actors, littered with some fun things in between with the Blob, the early appearance of the first appearance of Wade Wilson in the movie. There's some fun stuff along the way, but they decide that they need to shoehorn in all these other X-Men characters to Wolverine's movie. Because, you know, Wolverine can't sell a movie on his own.
No, of course not.
It's not like he's the most popular of the mutants.
It should have been a straightforward, stripped-down, like, revenge mm-hmm. thriller focused on Wolverine mm-hmm. and Sabretooth. That's all you needed.
Yep.
And to its credit, you know, this movie does inform later Wolverine solo entries, and where the plot, I think, is simplified greatly. The focus is narrowed intently on Wolverine rather than trying to have this expansive cast this movie does. So at the very least, I feel like it helped us get to where we needed to get as a Wolverine solo trilogy. Mm-hmm. But man,
Once you get to the halfway point in this movie, they get to the point where he is with was it Silver Fox?
Yeah, I'm gonna hit you with a real Sophie's choice here, Greg. What's a worst love interest in a superhero film? Kate Bosworth as Lois Lane, or whoever the hell this was as Kayla Silver Fox?
Moon Bloodgood, I think was her name. Believe it or not, Bosworth, but. Certainly this is in the running. I think this is around the level of what's her name as Carol Ferris.
She was played by Lynn Collins, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Who was Moon Bloodgood? Was she even in this movie?
I don't know.
Or was she just in – she was in that Terminator Salvation movie.
Yes.
Anyway, that character sucked. But she's about on the level of Carol Ferris in the Green Lantern movie, so a little bit above Bosworth, but not by much. Hmm. Just a terrible movie that I thought was going to sink the franchise and somehow didn't. So it's a credit to some of the movies we'll talk about later on this list that the franchise was even able to survive after what was such a disappointing movie. There's a scene in this movie that we always talk about, Nick, when you talk about the CGI, when Wolverine goes into the bathroom and looks at his freshly adamantium claws, and there is an inexplicable, like, PS2 level video game spark that comes off of the claws that may be the single fakest scene I've seen in a superhero movie. It's so bad.
It's pretty and it's so stupid, because my understanding is that the claws were mostly practical effects in all the X-Men movies that had predated them. You would see clips of Hugh Jackman walking around on set just holding a claw apparatus.
Yep.
And yet, for some reason, they decided to try and fix what wasn't broken. And I remember even the claws looked like they were physically out of place on his hands. They didn't even do a good job of the placement. It's just, it's the worst. It's the worst, and I'm glad to hear that you're you know, in agreement with me here, because I think most people would probably have what we have at number 10 as the dead last.
Well, let's get to that without any further ado. Mm-hmm. Both of our number 10 movies, and one of the things that you'll see over the course of our lists in this episode, I think, is, for me anyway, this was about groupings.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so to me than the MCU, it was easier to break the X-Men movies into groupings.
There are very clear delineations for me. Even though I have one movie coming up that's kind of in a group by itself, honestly.
Right.
Actually, a couple, I guess you could make that argument for. But, so this is kind of my the bottom tier was clear to me. And it was these two movies. They were right there kind of neck and neck. But mm-hmm. you make me choose one, and I picked X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Yeah, exactly. So this number 10 movie, we're both going to talk about it, so we'll just do it at the same time. X-Men The Last Stand from 2006.
Which we will be doing a very special edition of Off the Page covering that movie in 2 weeks here on the podcast. So we're going to revisit it and see how it compares to 2019's Dark Phoenix, because the movies, ostensibly anyway, were supposed to be adapting essentially the same source material. However, as we'll talk about, X-Men The Last Stand chose to not just adapt the Dark Phoenix saga, but seemingly five other storylines as well.
Yes. Yeah, so let me give a little context to The Last Stand. And I mentioned disappointment. The reason why this movie was nearly my pick for the worst is the crushing level of disappointment, because this was on the heels of 2003's X2 X-Men United, mm-hmm. which to this point was the to me was the standard bearer for superhero films. It was the certainly for ensemble superhero films
as of 2006. Yes,
it was a movie that changed the way that I looked at superhero movies. You know, it really did. The pacing, the cast, the story, it was so exciting. It was so well made. To me, still Bryan Singer's best film. And it all was put together in such a brilliant way, and it ended on such an exciting note with what happens to Jean Grey at the end of that movie. She sacrifices herself, and you see the image of the Phoenix in the water beneath the Blackbird, and instantly you're thinking to yourself, I remember leaving the theater the first time seeing X2, thinking, my God, that was amazing. But how much better is X-Men 3 going to be? I remember for 2.5 years, my friends and I at college could not stop talking about how excited we were for X-Men 3. There was no way they could screw this up. This was going to be the greatest superhero movie ever made. It had perfect build. You have to understand, this was pre-MCU. We had not to this point seen a superhero franchise that truly built one giant story to the next and had these kinds of hints and Easter eggs and nods to the comic books. So the fact that we were going to see this on the big screen was, to me, mind-blowing. It was going to change everything. It was going to even surpass the greatness that we had just seen with Spider-Man 2 a couple years before. And then the movie came out, and in the lead-up to the movie, Bryan Singer, who was the director of the first two X-Men movies, decided, kind of in the middle of developing this project, to walk away because he wanted to do Superman Returns, which is another story for another podcast. So he goes off to do Superman Returns, and the studio says, well, even though Bryan Singer has made it clear he would like to make X-Men 3, we don't want to wait. We don't want to wait on him to make his vanity project, Superman Returns. We want to go ahead and get this movie out. We can't wait. We got to get this movie out while the X-Men name is still hot. Typical movie studio logic. We don't want to wait for a great thing. We're going to push out what we hope is a good thing. So they go and get veteran director Brett Ratner.
Well, first, they actually hired Matthew Vaughn, who then also left the project before Ratner was ever hired.
Yep.
And if Matthew Vaughn had done it, it might have been good.
It might have been. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So they go out and they get Ratner, who's a veteran director at this point, had big success with the Rush Hour movies, and they bring him in, and they give a huge budget to this film, $210 million budget, the most expensive film at the time of the release. And the problem is so many cooks in this kitchen. Mm-hmm. They put together a movie in X-Men 3 that manages to be 104 minutes, less than 2 hours long. And that's not in itself a bad thing, except when you look at this cast and how many characters are in this movie.
And the budget. According to Wikipedia, and at the time, the budget was $210 million, which would have made it the most expensive film ever made at that juncture.
Indeed. And you have a cast that includes Hugh Jackman, Halle Berry, Ian McKellen, Famke Janssen, Anna Paquin, Kelsey Grammer, James Marsden, Rebecca Romijn, Sean Ashmore, Aaron Stanford, Vinnie Jones, and Patrick Stewart, all listed as stars in the movie. You have to give all these people characters and all these characters time, and that comes in under 2 hours. That just wasn't enough real estate to work with. And as a result, you end up with this movie, which is a combination of two distinct plots, which is, number one, they're looking for the cure. They have the cure for mutants, which is a common comic book storyline. It's a great storyline. No reason not to tell it. But they're also telling the Dark Phoenix saga. The corruption, the return and corruption of Jean Grey as she turns into the Phoenix. They also, for some reason, are obsessed with Magneto being the centerpiece villain of a film. So Magneto also has to be thrown in as a major villain. Mm-hmm. So you've got essentially three major antagonists in terms of the government, Magneto, and Phoenix. You've got Cyclops is killed in what feels like the first scene of the movie.
It's his first scene, yes.
And
his only scene in the movie, based on my memory of it anyway. No, I think he has a scene with Wolverine at the X-Mansion, and then he leaves, and then he's killed in his next scene.
This movie is such a mess that if you're going to try – first of all, you shouldn't try to tell those three stories at once.
No.
Magneto was done as a villain. There was no need for him to be the villain in this movie.
If anything, you need to do kind of what it looks like Dark Phoenix is doing, the threat that the Phoenix represents when she's – fully unleashed is truly warrants X-Men and Magneto putting their differences aside and banding together again, but not what they wanted to do.
And I actually just today, right before our show, read an interview with Simon Kinberg, who was the co-writer of this movie and is the writer and director of Dark Phoenix as well. And the interviewer asked him what went wrong with X-Men The Last Stand. And he said, look, I have the blood on my hands for that one because I was the co-writer. He said, we tried to fit too many story arcs in that. We tried to fit too many plots in it. Jean was almost insignificant in the movie because we felt like we had to focus on Xavier, Magneto, and Wolverine. And as a result, you can't really tell the Dark Phoenix saga with that. And I think that's true. And you smash all of this together in a less than 2 hour movie. And it ends up being a far bigger mess than Spider-Man 3 was, which also had similar problems of trying to fit too much story into one movie. And it'll be interesting when we revisit this. Maybe the movie's better than my memory of it is. I doubt it. But there was just too much going on here. Too little going on with the individual characters, because they had so many characters, it felt like none of them really got a focus except – the only – again, we'll come back to this throughout this list. The one great character in the movie is Wolverine. He's the one that has the compelling arc in the movie, and that's to the credit of Hugh Jackman's performance and also the fact that he's actually given a chance to shine in this one. There's good stuff along the way. I think certainly the final death scene with Jean Grey in this movie with her and Wolverine is very powerful. Still one of my favorite scenes, individual scenes in the X-Men movies. But again, Nick, just too much into one movie. I don't understand these Hollywood tendencies in some of these superhero movies to want to fit three or four distinct comic book arcs into one movie. We talked about it just recently with the Green Lantern movie. when we discussed it on the show. We talked about it with Spider-Man 3 before. We've talked about it with Amazing Spider-Man 2. Movies that just try to fit way too much story into a movie that would be better served to tell one good story.
Absolutely. And also, like you said, I mean, because of all these multiple storylines, you get plot threads that you had been waiting for, like you said, 3 years to get to see pay off that are kind of paid off in lackluster fashion. The one that I remember most notably, I was so excited to finally see the big Pyro versus Iceman throwdown. I was like, this ought to be like one of the showcase action sequences in the movie. It ought to be awesome. It lasted all of like 30 seconds, and as I recall, it was just them firing their powers at each other and water hitting the ground, and that was it.
Yep.
And I was so disappointed, but like other stuff.
Colossus
and Juggernaut, Kitty Pryde. I was like, oh, there's going to be some awesome action sequences. I was imagining in my head Kitty Pryde sequences that were, you know, like the spiritual successor to the Nightcrawler sequence from X2, because you can do that with that power set of her like running through walls and stuff. And yes, they try it, but I would argue it's uninventive and just falls flat near the end of that film.
Particularly, you have a problem with that scene because the Juggernaut has an aluminum foil helmet.
Right. Yes, it's bad. It's bad. But again, much like X-Men Origins Wolverine, you could have benefited from just streamlining this. The focus of this movie needed to be on Jean, Cyclops, Wolverine, and Xavier. Nobody else really needed to play a major role. Yes, you had to have the other X-Men characters there, but those should have been the emotional core of this movie. And one of those four, like we said, they kill off in the first 15 minutes. The other one is killed off halfway through the movie. And the movie becomes focused on Wolverine and Jean, which, while it's a dynamic I enjoy from the comics, kind of rings hollow for the story they had been telling in the movies to this point. It just and a complete misfire.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly in Jean's case, I think Kinberg says in that interview, another mistake they made in the movie is he said, we'll see this next week and see if it's true or not, but he said, I believe that Jean only has 5 spoken lines in the second half of the movie. You can't do a Phoenix story with that being the case. So yeah, huge miss on this film and a huge disappointment. And that's kind of my bottom tier. Those two movies, yes. 10 and 11, are the clear bottom.
Yes. This, you know, on the old Blog of Doom, Greg, we used to have what we called the Cody line, which was back in those days, the Cody Rhodes was the most mediocre wrestler on the face of the planet, by our estimation anyway. And so there was the Cody line. Beneath the Cody line rested below average, and above the Cody line rested above average. I'm going to institute here, Greg, the Baron Corbin line. And I'm going to say that X-Men The Last Stand and X-Men Origins Wolverine fall below the Baron Corbin line.
Yes, because Cody Rhodes has now become good.
Yes.
Over the course of time.
We might reuse the Cody line later on, but it'll have a different meaning.
Yes, these are below the these are, if you can believe it, folks, these are sub Baron Corbin movies.
Yes.
So let's get to our first above Baron Corbin movie. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be
here we go.
This is going to be perhaps the first movie on our list that might get us in some trouble.
This is if we're going the same movie at number 9, this I think will be easily the most controversial placement on our list.
Are you ready, Twitter?
Here we go.
Are you ready? Are you ready, Facebook?
Mike,
at number 9.
Mike, Ben Morse, get your quote tweet ready.
Get your quote tweet ready, and all your followers as well.
Yep. Get your mindless students to hop on your bandwagon.
At number 9,
here we go.
We have X-Men First Class.
Absolutely.
By director Matt Vaughn.
Absolutely. Let's start from here. It is a good movie. All the rest of these movies on this list. Well, let me walk that back a little bit. There are no more bad movies on the rest of this list.
Yes.
All the movies from here on out are competently made. They're entertaining enough. None of them are anywhere close to the train wrecks that Last Stand and X-Men Origins Wolverine are. So we are not saying that First Class is a bad movie.
No, that is not what we're saying. What we're saying is that we do not get the level of enjoyment from First Class that seemingly a large amount of people
everyone else gets. I remember when this movie came out in, 2009?
2011.
No, 2011. Okay. You and I both saw the movie relatively quickly after it opened, and we kind of talked about it shortly after, even from first viewing. Like, the reviews for this were just mind-blowingly good, and we both saw it, and I didn't get the love for it then, and I still don't get it to this day. Yes, the 60s aesthetic is cool. Yes, James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender are perfectly cast. Jennifer Lawrence is very good in the movie. Nicholas Holt's pretty good. But it Kevin Bacon's very good. But it rounds out the rest of the cast with a bunch of characters that I just don't give a shit about. And yet the movie likes to act as if it has earned me caring about these characters. When in fact it has not.
Right, yeah. I remember the first time I saw it, I really liked it because I think because it was such a breath of fresh air from what we had gotten with Origins and with Last Stand, that it was a breath of fresh air, and it did feel nice to see these new actors in these roles, freshening them up a little bit. But this is a movie that even at the time I had some reservations about when I watched it, and every subsequent watch of it, while it is still a competently made film that I can enjoy, and there are certainly legitimately great aspects of it, everything you just said rings true for me. I think that this is a movie that has high highs and low lows.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think, you know, we talked about some of the highs already. You did. McAvoy is outstanding as Professor X. Fassbender is somehow even better as Magneto. Jennifer Lawrence is great as Mystique. Kevin Bacon is outstanding as Sebastian Shaw.
All the Magneto stuff in this movie is phenomenal. Like,
I'll go further. I think this would have been better as a Magneto movie.
That's how it started. If you remember, when X-Men Origins Wolverine came out, we knew that they had in development a series of X-Men origin films, and one of those was going to be Magneto. And apparently, after Wolverine kind of, you know, bombed, this one morphed into First Class. And after seeing it, it should have stayed Magneto. Like,
yes, the stuff in the beginning of this movie
is amazing.
That takes that basically Magneto hunting down Nazis.
Oh.
Is a movie that to this day I would hand over my $16 or whatever it costs to go see a movie right now in IMAX to go see that.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Matthew Vaughn's direction of it is great. In that little section is probably one of the best X-Men movies that mm-hmm. never got made.
And arguably one of the best scenes when he is in the bar in Argentina.
Oh my God.
I think that's
God.
One of the best Amazing. X-Men movie scenes that's ever been put on film.
Absolutely. Another great scene on the submarine at the end with Magneto and Shaw and their showdown, amazing. So we've talked about the good stuff. Let's talk about what doesn't work. So this
every character other than the ones we specifically named earlier.
yes, one that we haven't even talked about right now. January Jones as Emma Frost.
Oh, here we go. Greg's hatred for January Jones has been known for some time.
So, I'm not going to get into the alleged backstage politics of all this, of how she got this role and all. I don't know the truth of any of that. All that I know is what I see on the screen.
Wait a minute. What's the alleged backstage politics of how she got the role?
I hesitate to even talk about it, but apparently she was in a relationship with Matthew Vaughn.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
And ended up being with child and all this other stuff. So anyway, she gives what I consider to be – you asked me earlier what could be below Kate Bosworth's Lois Lane. January Jones gives a worse performance as Emma Frost.
All right, I'm going to do your favorite thing about this movie, Greg. Are you ready for it? Are you ready for it?
Go ahead.
Now, Greg, don't you think you're being a bit unfair? Because isn't the character of Emma Frost supposed to be cold and distant anyway?
Listen. No, yeah. The problem is she's not cold and distant. She's cold and lacking a soul. She has no – Emma Frost has personality. Emma Frost has panache. Emma Frost is charismatic. and charismatic enough to win the love of Cyclops, as we learn in the comics. This Emma Frost is the most charismaless person this side of Baron Corbin. and that's a little harsh to Baron Corbin, even. So it's just an abysmal performance. Absolutely. There is no redeeming quality about her performance. The way they show her powers is stupid.
And, like, don't get me wrong, she's attractive. But you got to remember, they draw Emma Frost in the comics to be, like, one of the, like, most ideal peak female forms ever in the history of females. And I would argue that January Jones is not that.
Well, and regardless, they strip her of – this performance, rather, strips Emma Frost of any of her agency as a character. She's just a bit player. She's just a pawn, and she doesn't get that redemptive moment to show you that Emma Frost is not just a pawn of the Hellfire Club, that she, you know, eventually rises beyond that or does anything of note, really. She's terrible. Oliver Platt's in the movie and wasted. He's a good actor that's wasted.
Oh, Rose Byrne as not Irish Moira McTaggart.
What an odd one of very many odd continuity choices here, by the way, that I'll get to that in a second as well. Because remember, we had already seen Moira McTaggart in X-Men The Last Stand, tending to Charles Xavier. So we also get a character named Azazel, the controversial Azazel character from the comics, who is, as we know, I believe the father of Nightcrawler. And again, there's some great action scenes. He gets really great teleportation abilities. Not much of a character. Oh my gosh. Lucas Till as Alex Summers, a.k.a. Havoc.
Awful.
Awful. Terrible. Terrible.
I don't care anything about the character of Havoc in the comics.
I love Havoc.
I'm not an X-Men fan. You know, I don't know much about Havoc other than he's Cyclops' older brother who's kind of a dick.
Younger brother.
Is he his younger brother?
Yeah.
Well, in these movies, he's clearly the older brother.
In these movies, he's much older.
Yes, much, much older. This was – like, they gave you no reason to care about this character. It was just awful. Just awful. I mean, and that's really my complaint. You know, half the movie they spend putting this new team of X-Men together, characters like Banshee, characters like Havoc, characters like Darwin, characters like Angel, Beast, and Mystique. And yes, Beast and Mystique, because they spend other moments in the movie with them, you grow to care about them. But then midway through the movie, they kill off Darwin, who you've literally spent two scenes with, and they expect you to care about it. And you just don't.
A heel turn with the character of Angel, not Archangel that we know, not Warren Worthington, but a character named Angel Salvador. They do a heel turn with her that nobody cares about or buys because we don't have time to connect with these characters.
Right, exactly. And not to mention the optics of killing off Darwin, who is the only minority character.
The only African-American in the movie, yep. And he's killed off.
Angel is also a minority, but then she turns heel. So, like, what you have are the all-new, all-white X-Men.
What about, because I am a big Havoc fan from the comics, what about Havoc's ability in order to use his powers, he has to do a hula hoop motion.
And wear this goofy, like, giant circle on his chest.
Goofy circle, and do a hula hoop motion to push beams out of his chest. Just ridiculous looking. There are some silly things in here. And all of this is just as a movie. Like, as a movie. The CGI is mostly really good. There are a few moments where it hiccups, but mostly really good. But the action is uninventive at times. The characters are uninteresting, largely, outside of the ones that we mentioned. The side characters are certainly uninteresting. The movie loses momentum as it goes along because the Magneto stuff was so great. The Shaw stuff is mostly really good, but the Shaw team is not interesting. And then ultimately, let me put on my nerd glasses for a minute. It's just really hard for me to enjoy this movie on the level of the others when I look at it from a continuity standpoint and how it just demolishes the X-Men continuity with regards to Havoc, who is Cyclops' younger brother, being the age that Cyclops' father should be. just a bizarre choice that I will never understand as long as I live.
Have they ever confirmed they're actually brothers in the movie franchise?
No, okay. I don't think so.
So maybe it's just easier to imagine that they aren't.
The decision, the curious decision to include an American Moira McTaggart, who doesn't look to have anything to do with the X-Men The Last Stand Moira McTaggart.
But Rose Byrne is hot, so we'll give him that.
And the decision to include, even though Jennifer Lawrence is outstanding as Mystique in this movie, has a great relationship with Xavier, the decision to include Mystique in the original group of X-Men, playing fast and loose, including so many different characters in the original group of X-Men that just don't fit, no chemistry with the team to speak of, really. Just a lot of very curious.
And these characters, most of these X characters that survive this movie, don't even carry on into future movies. Like they go out of their way to distance themselves from this batch of X-Men. And I think that's with good reason.
It creates a problem in later movies that Magneto looks the same in the 1960s as he does in the 1990s,
which we will get to and hear. Well, no, I don't want to spoil anything on my list, but
probably the same as mine. So, yeah, but overall, you know, I feel like we're harping on this movie a lot. It is an entertaining movie, and it's one that I will still watch when it's on TV. But it's one that I watch, and I'm like, yeah, that was all right, you know. And there are great moments in it, but again, there are misfires and there are directions that bug me with some of the characters. Mm-hmm. And it's one that I think I think one of the great moments of controversy will probably be having this next movie ahead of it, but I stand by it because I just personally get more fan service, frankly, right, out of the next movie than I did out of this one.
I completely agree. At the risk of sounding like seat selection.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm going to go with another one that I think is just – it's fine. That's the way I feel about it. This grouping, I am going to deem – we decided before the show we were going to deem this grouping – for me anyway, the Zack Ryder line. This is the Zack Ryder line in that it's a serviceable wrestler who is inexplicably popular. And for me, what falls in that category, X-Men First Class, and at number 8, X-Men Apocalypse. You and I saw this movie when it came out a couple years ago. I think we were doing the podcast when this came out, I'm pretty sure, and talked mm-hmm. about it then. And you're much higher on it, I think, than I am. So it's interesting that you may be having it here at this same.
Yes, that is indeed my painting.
At the same spot, I expected you to go at least one spot higher, honestly, on this. My thing with it is it kind of suffers from a lot of the same problems as First Class does, in that you spend so much time in this movie putting together this new team of X-Men, and they just expect you to care about them by the end. I'm not saying that Sophie Turner as Jean Grey or Ty Sheridan as Cyclops or whoever the other people, Alexandra Shipp, I believe, playing Storm. I'm not sure the name of the kid playing Nightcrawler or the Angel Kid or even Jubilee. They're not bad per se in this movie. The problem is I do not feel a connection, great enough connection with these characters by the end of the film when they expect you to like feel this big fist-pumping moment that they have saved the day. And I especially take issue with the fact that in her first appearance, this version of Jean Grey is already exhibiting Phoenix powers. It feels like they are just desperate to get a chance to redo this Phoenix storyline, and as a result, a large portion of the climax of this movie feels rushed to me. Outside of that, it's a weird complaint to have. I'm going to acknowledge that. I thought Oscar Isaac's Apocalypse wasn't enough for me. It wasn't big enough. It wasn't over the top enough. It wasn't grandiose enough. Bonus points for never actually defining his powers. I'll say that.
Yes.
But yes. I wanted something more comic book from it. I wanted a more, a bigger, badder, more over the top costume design. I wanted scenery chewing. I wanted a pompous attitude. I'm not really sure what exactly I wanted. I know that this wasn't really it. But I come at that from the perspective of someone who is not a huge X-Men fan. So I'm interested to hear how this finished so low for you when at the time you were much higher on it than I was.
So this is the ultimate reason that this ended up where it did on my list is it has an inverse relationship with the next movie on my list, which is a movie that has been elevated by recent rewatches of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie that a recent rewatch of really not soured me on it, but certainly reduced my opinion of it from the jubilance that I had when I first watched it. No pun intended with that term. But when I first saw this in theater, I genuinely loved it because it felt like fan service for 90s X-Men fans. Even though the movie purports to take place in the 1980s, the costume designs were 90s. The aesthetics were 90s. Even to a degree, the design of Apocalypse was very, you know.
You're not going to be able to convince me that a movie that features Jubilee for a stretch is not 90s inspired. I'm sorry. You can scream it's from the 1980s all you want. I'm not buying it.
Right. And even the designs of these characters, Psylocke is not in her 1980s attire. She is in her British – sure, she is in her body-swapped Jim Lee attire mm-hmm. in the early 90s.
Yes, she is.
And so I gave this movie a lot of leeway and still do, by the way. But a recent rewatch of it revealed all the many issues that it has just holding together as a film. But I still have some affinity for this one
yep.
because of the fan service. You get right. Apocalypse. I remember I almost became emotional when I saw the first trailer for this movie because I never thought – I talked about the Avengers movies and Thanos and how important that was to me, right? The mm-hmm. seeing this from the time I read the Infinity Gauntlet, a character that seems so big, that seems so cosmic that I never thought I would see him in a movie. Apocalypse was the X-Men version of Thanos
absolutely,
for me.
Absolutely, yeah.
The character I never thought I would see in a movie. I just never thought they would even try to do it, particularly in the Bryan Singer universe did I think they would try Apocalypse. And to finally see it happen, and not just to see it happen, but to see him have vague, undefined powers and him grow to be a giant 20-foot-tall man or whatever – and have seemingly be able to do whatever he wanted to. It was just so cool to see Psylocke running around with her psychic daggers, using them on opponents. To see some of these, so many Beast in his furry form again with the blue skin and everything. You know, like you know from the cartoon and the comics
and. I think this has, you know, of all of the three movies he's been in, I think this has the best performance from James McAvoy as Charles Xavier, because yes. you kind of get a broken version of Xavier, you know, one that is, you know, hesitant to believe he can even do the things that he winds up doing, you know, which is we see that in Days of Future Past as well. But here,
yes.
you know, he feels overmatched entirely by Apocalypse. And so it's very interesting. And also it's got outstanding Magneto stuff in it as well.
Yeah. I was gonna say there the scenes again. I feel like we said this about First Class, and it's true here as well. There is a movie to be made about Magneto living with his family in the woods in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That whole sequence is incredibly interesting to watch. Like, very well made, very exciting. And heartbreaking. And there is – what I love about it, Nick, is it's kind of like watching a great horror movie because
you
just get the chills watching it. You know something's going to happen. You're just waiting on the shoe to drop.
And the revenge that he takes as a result of it is
– Yep.
Oh, top notch.
Is outstanding. Where the movie loses itself – and also I want to talk about the new cast. It's no one is ever going to match Alan Cumming for me as Nightcrawler. But Cody Smit McPhee does a good
That's
job.
That's right, Cody Smit McPhee
playing Kurt Wagner, Nightcrawler. We get a new version of Storm here that is really more along the lines of what we have in the comics. We get who else do we get added in here? We get the new Cyclops and Jean. Ty Sheridan as Cyclops instantly has, and this is coming from me, Nick, a guy that has never liked Cyclops, as we've been public on. I liked Cyclops in this movie. He had some personality. He had a little bit of edge to him. He had a little bit of, he wasn't the stick in the mud that maybe we've come to expect of Cyclops in some of these movies.
Right.
And Sophie Turner as Jean, she doesn't get a lot to do here, but she's good while she's here. Where the movie falls apart is it feels like it kind of loses itself about halfway through and becomes very scattershot with some of the subplots. I think Apocalypse's horsemen are underdeveloped in this one.
Absolutely.
Psylocke has almost no character to speak of. Even we were just praising her using the psychic daggers, but she really doesn't have a character in this movie.
Nope.
And I feel like all the heel characters in this movie are underdeveloped, maybe except Apocalypse. But the problem with Apocalypse is you don't really need to develop his character. You need to develop the characters of his horsemen, because Apocalypse is supposed to be this sort of like untenable,
yeah,
you know, Thanos basically, yeah. You know. And so you don't need a whole lot with him, but either you have to really have a compelling Apocalypse or a compelling Horseman, and they didn't really have that from a character standpoint. The end fight is really good.
Archangel looked cool, though. I'll give him that.
Archangel looked great. Yeah. It's the best usage of that character on film, for sure. And I think that, you know, the last scene, as I remember it, is good, but it's just such a CGI nightmare of – It's one of those scenes that's just kind of hard to follow. I liken it to kind of one of those big monster fights at the end of some of these modern monster movies.
Or a Transformers movie.
Yeah, or a Transformer movie where it's just hard to follow anything or tell what the hell's going on. So, this is a movie that I like more than I think most people do, acknowledging its problems, but that's why it ends up at number 8 on my list. Recent rewatches have lowered it. It may lower even further in the future, but for now, I give it the slight edge over First Class simply because of the fan service elements of being able to see some of these visual images that I never thought I would see as a kid.
Yeah, I can certainly agree with that. And I think, for me, it's the action sequences I think are a little better than First Class. I think you are getting into an era of X-Men that I care a little bit more about in terms of the Jean Grey and the Cyclops of it all, rather than, you know, Darwin or Angel or whoever we talked about before. And the Magneto stuff here continues to be great, and I think the Xavier stuff is a little better. So, yeah, it's close between these two, much like my bottom two films, but I give the slight edge to Apocalypse, even though I'm ultimately kind of underwhelmed by both of them, I guess.
Yes. Well, then that brings us to number 7, and I get a weird feeling that we're probably going to have the same movie at number 7.
Yeah, we are. But one thing I'll add right here is that if we're doing this tier separation, this is one of the movies that kind of stands alone in its own tier for me, because I think it is, for my own taste, definitively better than either Apocalypse or First Class, but also definitively far, far worse, not even close to as good as the three movies in particular that I have in kind of the next tier ahead of it. So, this would kind of be what the original Cody line was, the definition of average. And I'm not really sure, I'm trying to think of a modern day example, Greg. Get back to me on that. I don't have a terming for this tier yet. Yes. You continue.
Yes. My movie at number, which is the same as yours at number 7, is going to be the original 2000 X-Men movie by Bryan Singer. This is a movie that, in full disclosure, I've always, not always, when I first saw it, like every kid that saw it that year, I was blown away.
Yes.
I came out of the theater with my jaw dropped. Subsequent better superhero movies caused me to think that I didn't like this movie that much. Right. And subsequently I would kind of trash talk, as you know, I would trash talk this movie over the years. And
the same thing you have done to Spider-Man over the years, the 2002 Sam Raimi Spider-Man, which re-examine next month during Spider-Man month.
That's fair to say, or is it? We'll determine next month.
We will. I know how that's going to go, and I think you do too.
But I don't want it to be the case. I've enjoyed my hatred of that character But anyway, but this is a movie that only on our rewatch for this show that we did with Tim Capel, I believe
that was like
2 years ago.
That was one of the first like five episodes of the podcast. That was super early.
It was only when we went back and reviewed this movie with Tim Capel and I rewatched it for the first time in several years, unedited, not on TV, mm-hmm. that I realized that this is a pretty damn good movie.
And let me tell you why it still holds up. It might be the best casting of any superhero movie of that era. Mm-hmm. You go up and down the cast, and I really can't find, outside of Tyler Mane as Sabretooth, which really is not so much an issue with the casting as it is an issue with the version of that character they're trying to portray. Everything else on that cast is perfect. I mean, whether it's Patrick Stewart as Charles Xavier.
Patrick Stewart was instantly the voice of Charles Xavier.
Yeah, he was amazing. Ian McKellen as Magneto is perfect. Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. Halle Berry as Storm. I mean, James Marsden as Cyclops.
Cyclops, yeah.
You know, Anna Paquin as Rogue. What's the guy? What's the kid's name that plays Bobby Drake in the movies?
Sean Ashmore.
Sean Ashmore as Bobby Drake. I mean, up and down the cast, it's just a phenomenal cast. And these, like you said, the movie itself is just a good movie. There's nothing like, I don't think there's anything overwhelmingly, groundbreaking or iconic about it looking back on it these many years later. But these versions of the characters in many cases are still like the versions of the characters I see in my head whenever I think about these characters.
And it's a really clever script. We talked about
it. It really is,
this.
Yeah.
Joss Whedon had a hand in this script, and it's very, very clever. There's really good dialogue here, great character building. The way that they instantly, in my opinion, wisely, make you realize that Wolverine is the focal point character in this series. And that's clear from the first scene, or the first early parts of this movie. And once you get that established, they do an amazing job following his journey. His interactions with Scott and Jean felt so natural from the comics and from the cartoon especially. You know, there's the scene later on in the film when, you know, Mystique's been around and she's shown off her powers. They've done the Wolverine versus Wolverine fight. And then Wolverine comes back and Scott's like, "How do we know it's you?" And then he's like, "You're a dick." And he's like, "All right, it's him." Just a perfect relationship between them. Logan trying to get in Jean's pants from the moment that he sees her.
Yes.
Xavier and Magneto's chess game. You know, just so many great moments. To me, one of the iconic scenes is when Magneto forces all the cops' guns to turn on him,
mm-hmm.
and he cocks them, and you think he's going to kill all these cops. Great scene. And again, it can't be understated just how important this movie was for superhero.
Yeah, this came out in 2000, and you know, it's insane to think about, Greg. Only 3 years separate this from Batman and Robin,
mm-hmm.
but it feels like a lifetime in terms of the approach that had changed. Because as you know, in between Batman and Robin and this film, we had Blade, but they had really kind of gone out of their way to market that as more of a horror action movie and steer less, you know, from the comic book connotations. This was the first one to come along, really, since Batman Returns. But we've talked about how those Tim Burton Batman movies are ultimately, you know, more Tim Burton movies than they are superhero movies, that were like, no, we're going to embrace our superhero roots, but we're not going to do it in a joking fashion. We're going to mostly play this straight, which was unprecedented at the time. A movie like that had never really been made.
Yeah, and to do so in a way that was introducing a cast of characters, a team of characters, mm-hmm. not just one character like Richard Donner with Superman or Tim Burton with Batman, but a team of heroes, and to do it in a way where they established a rapport that felt natural. They established a universe that you were interested in seeing going forward. and told a good story along the way with some great, clever dialogue. So yeah, to me,
really is a good story. I mean, the Senator Robert Kelly of it all, played by, I believe, Bruce Davison. He's another great cast member in this movie. It all just works. I mean, it's still, I think the plot still holds together all these years later, which we talked about when we reviewed it a few years ago. One thing I just learned from Wikipedia, this features a cameo from George Buza, who you may know as the voice of Beast in X-Men the Animated Series. He actually appeared in the movie as the truck driver who drops Rogue off at the bar right before she meets Wolverine for the first time.
Wow, that's a nice bit of trivia that I had no idea about.
Mm-hmm.
So this movie was a huge success, and without this, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. This episode wouldn't even be happening. So,
and arguably, superhero film as we know it would not have been happening, because yes, there was a Spider-Man movie that was getting ready to come out, but Spider-Man had kind of languished in development hell for many years. Yep. Once X-Men hit big at the box office, and there's a joke about this even in one of my, a film I like a lot, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. One X-Men hit it big at the box office, movie studios started optioning comic book properties left and right. And that's kind of accurate, because within the next 10 years, we got Ghost Rider movies and Daredevil movies and, you know, all these movies that we never would have imagined we would see.
Yep.
Kind of happened because everybody was chasing that X-Men dollar at this point.
Absolutely, like Virgil chasing his own kind of money. Mm. But yes, certainly a movie that money. To me stands the test of time. Well, let's go to the next line, shall we, Nick?
Let's go.
Let's go to the next tier, and let's get into the really good shit.
Yes, this is kind of we have separated the wheat from the chaff, whatever the hell that saying means. I've never understood it, and. We kind of have a top six here, and for me, Greg, I don't know about you, I don't want to spoil it too much, but this next grouping, I kind of have a chunk of three here at four, five, and six.
Mine ended up being a chunk of four, and I think this is actually going to be where ours divide a little bit, because I made a rather interesting choice to divide two movies. Mm-hmm. But I think what you're getting at, Nick, is that this was really getting a nut cut in time, and this was the hardest for me.
Yes.
Area of separation, what we're about to come into.
Yeah, absolutely. So thus far, let's remind people, our lists have been identical. We had X-Men Origins at Wolverine at 11, Last Stand at 10, First Class at 9, Apocalypse at 8, and X-Men at 7. So let's see if our number six differs or not. You go first.
My number six is going to be James Mangold's The Wolverine.
Mine as well. So we are still identical at this point. And this
still identical.
This was impossibly hard, because
yep.
We'll talk about this as we talk about the next two movies that are ahead of it. The two movies I was comparing it to could not be any more different from this movie. They are doing two totally different things, going for two totally different vibes, arguably trying to reach two different audiences. And yet, in terms of succeeding what they set out to do, I feel like they're so damn close to each other. It was so hard.
Yep.
But ultimately, I put the Wolverine here, but beneath those other two, because we're going to talk about all the things we love about it. What I kind of knock for it, Viper as a character kind of doesn't fit in the grittier fit for this movie. Having
the last action scene.
I was about to say, having a literal cybernetic silver samurai doesn't really fit with the aesthetic of this movie.
Agreed.
Other than that, this is outstanding, and I was convinced it was going to be the best Wolverine movie we would ever see for a few years, until that was no longer the case, as we'll discuss later. But yeah, Wolverine is six for me as well. And I kind of hate to put it that low, because I love this movie. Like we've said, these next six are legitimately great movies that hold up there favorably with any MCU movie, honestly, outside of maybe a handful.
Yep, agreed completely, Nick. This movie is a very special one for me. As you know, Wolverine is my favorite Marvel character to this day. And this movie is based, at least in part, and relies heavily on, in my opinion, the very best Wolverine story that's ever been told, which was the Chris Claremont, Frank Miller Wolverine miniseries, which we've talked about on this podcast before, that take the Japan story, as people know it. And that's pretty much the basis, the backbone of this movie, The Wolverine. And this movie does an amazing job of converting not just that story, because this movie goes beyond that story and does its own thing and tells its own story, but of taking the feel and the vibe, which I think is so much more important than going by the letter of what was on the page. It takes the feel and the vibe of that story, and it gets Logan in a way that I would argue the comic books haven't gotten Logan in a long time. And it instantly gives me – from the very beginning of this movie, Nick, I knew I was going to love it. From the very first time we see Logan in this movie, when he's they recreate a scene directly out of that comic book with the bear that gets shot with the poison arrow. And Logan hunts down the guys that kill the bear.
Ask me how I found it. How'd you find it? Funny you should ask.
Yep. Amazing scene. Badass, violent, true to the character.
And our first look at Yukio in that scene as well.
And our first look at Rila Fukushima as Yukio, who
was a badass also.
Amazing.
Yeah.
She in some ways stole the movie at times, because if Jackman wasn't so good and so dedicated to his character, she would have stolen this movie from him, because she is a ball of charisma and a ball of badassery. She, you know, we would know her later. She would appear on Arrow as Katana.
That's right.
And did a great job on there as well. But she gets more to do here, and she is just a dynamo in this movie. I have no idea why she hasn't been in other Hollywood blockbusters after this. Yukio is just phenomenal, which if people know her from the comics, she is charismatic. She is a ball of charisma in the comics. And Fukushima really does a great job with her chemistry with Logan here of this warrior who's kind of and this noble samurai that are kind of like eyeing each other like, what are you here for? You know, and they're not sure if they can even trust each other. But it's such a great dynamic. She's this amazing soldier of sorts. We get the outdoorsmanship of Logan. The fact that they managed to salvage something out of X-Men: The Last Stand, Nick. The fact that they use the basis of Wolverine's depression, and he's just content to basically live out the rest of his days in the wilderness now as a result of the guilt that he feels for having killed Jean at the end of X-Men: The Last Stand. They took something that was a bad movie and they salvaged it to make a great movie. So this movie, I agree with you, Nick. The part that hurts it is at the end, the third act, if you will, when they get to the end and he has the big showdown with the giant mechanical silver samurai. But I would argue that everything up to that,
oh, was great.
Everything after that,
you know what? It is crazy.
As good as we've seen,
because the action sequence that directly precedes him fighting the silver samurai is wonderful with all the ninjas like firing the arrows at him and stuff. It's
again,
so
a comic
good.
Book sequence.
Yes,
a comic book looking sequence where he's got all those arrows and the spears, really the harpoons that are in him, and they're pulling at him.
And you can
and
almost
he's fighting against them.
And you can almost set that scene in black and white because it's in the pitch of dark. The buildings are mostly painted in a dark aesthetic. You have the white of the snow. You have the white of Jackman's bare chest, because at that point he's shirtless, and the black of the ninjas. You like, I could easily see that fitting. In like later on, you know, James Mangold would release the black and white cut of Logan. I can easily see that sequence fitting in a black and white cut,
and fits. It almost looks like a Frank Miller comic book sequence.
Yes, it's very good
if you think about it. The way it's laid out, it was very Frank Miller and good Frank Miller at that. And even all of the scenes on the streets of Tokyo. Tokyo is such a beautiful city to see in films. We've talked about that before about other movies offline and stuff, but it's such a beautiful city to see on screen, and the scenes in Tokyo with particularly the fight scene, I'm thinking after Mariko's wedding, is sensational, where Wolverine is trying to protect Mariko from the assassins coming after her. If you recall, Nick, and they have the train sequence, the train fight scene. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the best action scenes in a superhero movie to me. So what is something about superheroes and trains? Because you think about Spider-Man 2, you think about the Wolverine, and they both have these iconic train-related fight sequences. But this one stands out right up there with the best that I've seen. It's so good. clever usage of Wolverine's abilities. Again, creative fight scenes, which weren't always the case in superhero movies over the years. Really inventive fight scenes. Mangold has a respect for traditional martial arts cinema, and that comes through here as well. Jackman is in insane shape for this movie. So it's a modern classic. It's a damn fine superhero movie. And to this point, the best interpretation of Wolverine that we had gotten. And it's kind of shocking that I have five movies ahead of this.
Yeah, same, pretty much identical thoughts. So there you go. Moving on to number five.
Yes, what do you have it there?
This might have been the toughest, like, separation between four and five for me. And ultimately, I kind of just went with my gut, my most recent impression, and I totally acknowledge that if I watch these two movies again, I might flip. But as of today, I'm going to put Deadpool, the original Deadpool, at number five.
That's my painting.
All right.
We're still in line.
Well, we're not going to have an identical list. I know that for a fact. Yes. So that's good at least. But anyway.
Well, let's hear your thoughts on Deadpool first.
I mean, in terms of like trying to explain why it's beneath the movie that it's ahead of it, I have no real reasoning. It's that simple. It was literally just I'll talk about it in a little bit. I don't want to give too much away. This movie succeeds at virtually everything it sets out to do. Ryan Reynolds is the part that he was born to play. Nobody else, I don't care what Disney thinks or does in the future, nobody else should ever play this role. I don't care if they have to make decades of old man Deadpool movies. This is the only person who should ever play it. And this was his passion project. I mean, he is almost directly responsible for the fact that this movie even exists, because after X-Men Origins Wolverine, this movie was dead in the water. It was never going to get made. And it was, if it weren't for Ryan Reynolds himself leaking test footage that was shot that went viral online, this movie probably still wouldn't exist. And so after that happened, they kind of released this Deadpool movie that they mostly just let him do whatever the hell they wanted, shot it on a, by superhero standards anyway, by a shoestring budget. Only had like an hour and 40 or 35 minute runtime, so not barely a feature length live action movie, and yet it's amazing in every respect. It is completely unique. It is completely its own creation. It stands apart from every X-Men movie. It's so difficult to compare these and rank these compared to other more straightforward and self-serious X-Men movies. And yet, it's truly a remarkable accomplishment.
Nothing like it. And you speaking to this being Ryan Reynolds' passion project really brought this up. He deserves all the credit in the world for this, because nothing like this had ever even been attempted.
Right.
Right?
Right.
This is different from any Marvel movie, any DC movie, any comic book related movie you can think of. It was a meta comedy. Mm-hmm. A comedy almost about the absurdity of superhero movies. And it just could not have been made without Ryan Reynolds making it happen.
Absolutely. And Ryan Reynolds, of course, is the star, and he's phenomenal in this movie. But you've got they kind of rounded it out with a pretty damn good supporting cast. T.J. Miller playing this version of Weasel, I believe, is very good. Some nice some camaraderie, kind of a buddy cop type deal with him and Deadpool at various times. You've got, I don't even know who plays Cyclops, or excuse me, Colossus, but this over-the-top Russian accent-having version of Colossus is a very welcome change from the more generic version that we saw in X2 and X3. You've got Marina Baccarin playing his lady love, which is something I never really would have thought I would have cared about in a Deadpool movie, but and yet it was there, and it was damn good. You've got Brianna Hildebrand as Negasonic Teenage Warhead, which is a perfect character to pick out to use in a Deadpool movie just to cut jokes on the name of the character and stuff. So really, I mean, the only like real criticism I guess you could have of it is the villain is kind of not that great, but it doesn't need to be, because and
they even make fun of that during the movie,
right?
like the fact that Ajax is kind of boring and generic is actually referenced during the film,
right? So. And it didn't. This movie does what X-Men Origins Wolverine and X-Men The Last Stand should have done, it doesn't try to expand, do this expansive cast with these multiple plot lines. This is one movie telling one story. It is focused, and it absolutely works in every respect. I love this movie.
Yeah, it's a movie that has an identity as a straight. It's a comedy first and foremost. It knows what it is. It is a comedy that. And here's the other thing. It's R-rated. We haven't even talked about that.
Yes.
It's an R-rated superhero movie, which is very rare. And it's an R-rated superhero movie that has no restrictions on its content. They go after everything and everyone under the sun. DC Comics, Marvel Comics, anything related to superhero film is fair game in this movie. And yet, even though it's a movie that is filled with gags that we'll remember the rest of our lives, funny, hilarious, but I still remember the theater experience for this. I was in tears laughing at times during this movie, as was the entire theater. But yet, against shock of shocks, I still find myself compelled by the story that it tells.
Right.
Which is a testament to the movie, because at the end of the movie, you're invested in this relationship between Wade and Vanessa. When any other movie that tries to do this, you probably don't care about the relationship part of it. You're just thinking of it in terms of, let's get to the next joke. But here, by the end of this movie, I'm genuinely invested in this relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think, Nick, if there's one element that maybe was the deciding factor in splitting the two movies for me, because they're so very close, this tier, you know, I could flip-flop these easily and make an argument for it. But I think the fact that I connected to this relationship in this movie is what makes Deadpool 2 all the more effective.
Yes.
As we'll talk about later in our lists. So, but yes, it's a testament to this film. To Ryan Reynolds, to director Tim Miller, who walked away after this one, but did this one. It's a testament to both of them and the screenwriters that this movie holds together both from a story standpoint and from a comedy standpoint. It's so well done. The action. I'm an action guy. We know that by this point. It's kind of my gimmick. I'm into action movies, and I judge action scenes harshly. This movie has some phenomenal action sequences, some brutal action sequences. It's very appropriate for the character. It opened up the X-Men universe in a way that arguably should have been done beforehand. In terms of, it almost feels like Fox kind of throwing their hands up and saying, you know what? We've been lapped at this point in terms of making traditional superhero movies by Marvel,
right,
or by Marvel Studios. So we're going to do something that Marvel Studios isn't going to do and make a movie that they would not do. And we get that with another movie that will pop up later on in the list, in addition to the sequel to this movie, a movie that probably would never have been made if not for this franchise. So I think this Deadpool movie is sort of one of the things that I will remember the most now that we're kind of at the tail end of the Fox X-Men universe. So
absolutely.
Certainly, Nick, a worthy movie on our list.
Yep. So let's move on to the number four movie on our list. And
here is where we will diverge.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I knew it was coming at some point. I have Deadpool 2 at number four.
Well, go ahead and talk about it, and then I'll reveal my number four.
Okay. So the reason here is because I can't separate Deadpool and Deadpool 2. I enjoy mm-hmm. them almost identically. They are
completely understand.
Like they are nearly impossible to separate. And like you said, the reason I ultimately wind up going Deadpool 2 over Deadpool, I actually think Deadpool is a little funnier than Deadpool 2, even though they're mm-hmm. the gags, there are, for example, the baby dick gag in Deadpool 2 is just out of this world, hilarious. But what Deadpool 2 does is it takes a character who is a joke, and yet it shocks you with how much you actually care about this character and the emotional trauma he goes through in the movie. I was not expecting to give a shit that he lost the love of his life in this movie. I was mm-hmm. not expecting to care about him finding this family, essentially. And yet, I did. So combine that with the outstanding – the X-Force sequence in this movie is one of the best things I've ever seen in a comedy. Like –
absolutely.
Because
no
it
doubt.
Subverts every expectation. They marketed that as like the central driving point of the third act of this movie. And instead, it was a gag. It was brilliant on the part of Ryan Reynolds and the people over at Fox. So so much here. You know, Josh Brolin is Cable.
And how good is he as Cable? He's like, perfect.
Fantastic. Ryan Reynolds still continues to be born to play this part, and the greatest post-credit scenes in the history of post-credit scenes in Deadpool 2. Mm-hmm. Those things add up to give this the slight nod over Deadpool for me.
Yeah, the post-credit scenes are just... I watched this movie again, Nick, about 2 weeks ago on HBO Go, maybe 3 weeks ago. And I watched the re-released version of it, the one they did for Christmas, Once Upon a Deadpool. Mm-hmm. And they left the post-credit scenes intact. And it got me again because I'd forgotten about them. It got me all over again. Oh, God. So good. Well, I made the – I mean, it's all through these – really, in particular, these three movies, Deadpool and then the next two movies on my list with the Wolverines just ever so slightly behind are so close in quality that I could have flip-flopped the order. But what I did here is I split the difference, and I went with my number four movie, X-Men Days of Future Past. Mm-hmm. This is the opposite of X-Men The Last Stand. Here's what I mean by that. X-Men The Last Stand, I talked about earlier, being my most anticipated superhero movie, along with Green Lantern, in fairness, of all time. I guess you could throw in, like, Dark Knight Rises in there as well. But this was the movie that – and Endgame as well. This was the movie that I was looking forward to like nothing else, and it let me down in such a colossal way that nothing other than Green Lantern compares. This is the opposite, because I think both of us were, let's be kind and say, skeptical.
Yes, highly.
About Days of Future Past, because we talked about it in the weeks and months leading into this movie. How are they going to balance? We saw what happened with The Last Stand, trying to fit too much story in. How in the hell are they going to pull off all of these characters, all of these timelines? How are they going to tell a cohesive narrative that makes sense, that tells a story, that makes you care about the characters, that holds together to scrutiny? And how are they going to do this in a one-movie runtime? How are they going to tell this iconic comic book story in a reasonable amount of time? And again, Nick, this is the opposite situation, because I went and saw this movie and we walked out, and I still feel this way. There's an argument to be made that this is the best X-Men movie other than that is focused on the team. Let's put it that way. That it was this and X-Men 2 instantly. Mm-hmm. I walked out of the theater and I was confident. I said, this and X-2 are so far beyond the rest of the field. It's ridiculous in terms of team X-Men movies. And I walked out thinking this was as good as I've seen in the MCU. This is just an incredible
– At the time, because this came out in what, 2014?
14, yep.
So that's the same year – what was going on in the MCU in 2014?
Winter Soldier had just come out.
So, yep. Yeah, I would – absolutely. I think this is just as good as anything the MCU had done to that point. And I would mostly stand by that.
Yeah, I agree. It was an accomplishment too, like a level of accomplishment. I think we talked about this, that like you just have to give it up to Bryan Singer and Simon Kinberg and Jane Goldman, who wrote the movie, that they were able to pull this together because it works. And also credit to Matthew Vaughn for contributing to the story as well. Mm-hmm. It works in a way that most of these movies didn't, in terms of. We talked about the massive cast, and this has a massive cast. Hugh Jackman, James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Halle Berry, Anna Paquin, Ellen Page, Peter Dinklage, Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, and it holds together beautifully.
It does.
It remains one of my favorite comic book movies of any kind.
Yes.
And what you see in this movie is you get to see, get this emotional send-off to the old cast. You get to see Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen back one more time to play their iconic roles. You get to say goodbye to them. You get this incredible action sequence in the future with a character named Blink that I hope they do something with in the MCU, because what a cool power. This sort of she creates portals essentially, and this leads to this awesome teen fight scene at the beginning. You get to see Rogue again if you have the Rogue cut. You get to see all the characters that you kind of grew to love in the first, particularly the first two X-Men movies. You get to say goodbye to them, and you get to really embrace the younger cast acting alongside this otherworldly, iconic Hugh Jackman Wolverine. And seeing Wolverine interact with the younger Magneto and the younger Xavier and the younger Mystique, it's just special, man. It's one of Hugh Jackman's greatest performances mm-hmm. in this series. He has to be kind of the point of view character for a change in this series, and he's kind of he's the audience's stand-in in this movie of kind of like, we don't know what's going on, he doesn't know what's going on, and the other characters are kind of the agents of change acting around him. Just a brilliant job of putting this movie together. So many awesome performances from so many great actors in this. I want to draw particular attention to Jennifer Lawrence's performance in this movie, to Michael Fassbender in this movie, and to James McAvoy yes. as Xavier, who is sensational, whether it's as the broken, grizzled Charles Xavier or the Charles Xavier who finally comes to embrace his destiny of what he is and what he's supposed to be. Also, of course, in classic X-Men fashion, there's great metaphors in here. There's great usage of Peter Dinklage playing the iconic Bolivar Trask mm-hmm. character. There's some really cute and clever, funny jokes in the movie, and there's some subversion of expectations with regards to what happens with Wolverine at the end, with kind of the state of the X-Men at the end of this movie. So I can't say enough good things about this movie. And like I said, Nick, I kind of split the difference here to be a little bit different, but really it accomplishes what it's trying to do just as well as Deadpool accomplishes what it's trying to do.
Absolutely. So I'll let you go ahead and give your number three, since you said you kind of had these in a tier. My tier was you know, the two Deadpool movies and Wolverine kind of in a tier to themselves. So I'll let you go ahead with your number three here.
In my number three role, I've got Deadpool 2.
Yep.
And this is a movie that is again, it is very difficult to separate these films. You've said a lot of great things about this movie already. But for me, ultimately, I said that relationship connection that I had in the first Deadpool movie is what makes the sequel work even better. And that's true. I agree with you that maybe the first one is just a tad bit funnier, although two maybe has bigger laughs when it does have laughs, which is a lot. It's also directed by David Leitch, who is the director from one of the co-directors of John Wick, and it shows because the action in this movie is even beyond what we saw in the first Deadpool movie. The action is just sensational here. The fight scenes are great. But also, that emotional through line of Deadpool's character arc here is so compelling. Not what you're expecting out of a Deadpool movie, right? You're expecting to go in and laugh, particularly a Deadpool sequel, because how easy would it have been just to fall back on doing the same thing as the first movie? But instead of just remaking the first movie, they make this one somehow even more emotionally resonant and focus really on what makes Wade Wilson tick and why he is the way that he is. And we also get an incredible Cable by Josh Brolin. We get we get Morena Baccarin is outstanding when she's there. And we get introduced to some pretty cool new characters. The best Colossus that we've seen on screen.
Yes.
We also get the real freaking Juggernaut. Oh, my God. Voiced by Ryan Reynolds, actually.
Really? I did not know that.
Ryan Reynolds plays Juggernaut in this movie, and it's the real Juggernaut. This is the guy that we know from the comics. We even get – they don't just go that far with Juggernaut. They don't just give us the monstrous, hulking, nothing can stop the Juggernaut. They give us Black Tom fucking Cassidy. Of all supporting X-Men characters, they give us Black Tom Cassidy, whose mutant power, of course, was that he was Juggernaut's friend. And
and that he was a racist.
Oh, terrible, yes. And think about and of course, I got to give credit to the kid, Julian Dennison, mm-hmm. as Fire Fist, that plays a huge role in this
film.
Is that
the literal mutant name?
Yes.
I didn't know.
I'll be Fire Fist. And this sort of this makeshift family that Wade picks mm-hmm. up over the course of this movie, while being so funny, the X-Force sequence that you talked about, one of the best things I've ever seen in a movie. And every one of these movies seems to have one performance that comes out of nowhere to steal the movie. I didn't mention this in my Days of Future Past talk, but that was probably Quicksilver in Days of Future mm-hmm. Past, who really shocked people by like just kind of coming out of nowhere and being this ultra compelling character. In this case, Domino.
Yeah, oh yeah, Domino. Zazie Beetz.
Zazie Beetz as Domino. How they portrayed her luck power.
That one sequence is pretty damn good.
Oh my gosh. It was like, because I always, Domino's another character I always wondered how they would do in a movie, because how do you Who's really the portray other one luck?
In the X-Men that has a similar power? Longshot, yeah.
It's like, how do you portray probability fields in a movie? And, which they haven't really tried with Scarlet Witch.
Yeah, I was about to say, you just ignore them.
I was like, how do you even do that? And then this movie shows that it can be done because right. Domino is awesome yes. in this movie. Yes. She is outstanding, as is the rest of the team. We get Negasonic is back, Weasel is back, and he has some great lines as usual. The old lady is back from the first
Blind
movie.
Blind Al, yes.
Yeah, she's great as well.
Dopinder, the cab driver.
Yes. Wanting so badly to be a part of the team.
Right.
He wants to be a contract killer. And Stefan Kapicic voices Colossus.
You mentioned Weasel. One of my favorite lines in the movie. When he says something to the effect of, if you're going to go after him, be warned. There's a high wind advisory in effect. And then it comes into play in the damn sequence.
Oh God!
Yes, it's
so good. Yeah. If it had, it would have been funny enough if it hadn't come back.
No, yeah.
If but it the fact that it comes back and yes. plays a role, it incredible.
Yes.
One thing I want to go back to the original Deadpool. Great Stan cameo in that one. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the stage, Chastity. but here, we don't get that. But we do get just an outstanding, outstanding movie with a brief appearance from some of the other X-Men. We get
Kelsey Grammer comes back.
Yep. We get the amazing post-credit sequence that we've already talked about. The best post-credit sequences ever. And just a movie that makes me happy every time I watch it. That's all I can. Even the Once Upon a Deadpool version that adds in the footage with Fred Savage is just wonderful. And
I haven't watched that yet, but I need to.
It's not as good as the theatrical as a whole.
Yeah, there's no way it's so much out because it's PG-13.
But the Fred Savage stuff is worth it because yeah. it's so goddamn funny.
Right.
So just such a great movie. Again, so hard to separate these great movies from one another. It's harder to separate the great movies from the bad ones.
Yes.
But anyway, that's my number three movie. What about you?
All right. So this moves into my next tier, and I've kind of got these two movies. These are close for me, but I'm pretty confident in what I put at number two. I don't really feel apprehension about it the way I used to when I would express this opinion, so I'm a little more confident in it now. So at number three, I have X2, X-Men United. And that, you know, again, we're going to have to do this MCU thing where me having it below another movie mm-hmm. forces me to talk about the things that, like, hold it back from being as good as that movie again. Let me start by saying I love X2. I still think it's one of the best superhero movies ever made. It's still probably being like a top like 15 or so, just because there have been so many good MCU mm-hmm. movies in recent years that it probably has fallen down a little bit, but it's still, you know, near up there in that upper echelon. The Wolverine sequence, of course, is outstanding. Pyro snapping at the Drake household is still one of my favorite things. Ian McKellen is arguably even better somehow in this one than he was in the first
yeah.
one, which is almost impossible to believe.
Love what you've done with your hair.
You're a god among insects. Never let anyone tell you different. is that what they say? Oh, just so many great lines. But like in the plot,
what do you want to do? Scratch it with your claws.
And the plot is damn perfect almost. It holds together. Like yep. it's a tight, suspenseful narrative. It's really damn good. And the setup near the end with Jean giving her ultimate sacrifice, you've spent an entire movie with that character, you care about this character, and then that little visual tease of where they were going next. I remember how excited we all were for X3. I just think that the movie that that I have at number two... I'll get there, but I love this movie. I don't want to talk about my number two movie just yet, but X2, outstanding film. For the longest time, it was far and away the best X-Men movie, and it wasn't until relatively recently that it even got challenged. I mean, it stood unchallenged for 10 years, essentially.
Totally so. And that is my number two movie, X2, so I'll go ahead and talk about it. Mm-hmm. Directed by Bryan Singer, of course, following up on the heels of X-Men 1. This movie is 133 minutes long. And I'll be honest with you, Nick, I had no idea because it is the fastest moving 133-minute movie that I've ever seen in my life.
It's like The Dark Knight. Like, The Dark Knight is over 2.5 hours long, and I have seen The Dark Knight at least 60 times now in my life, and like I have never felt the length of that movie, not once. Mm-hmm. Not a single time.
Nope. Sometimes you feel the girth, but not the length, ever.
But you like girth.
That's right. It enhances the pleasure of the film. Mm-hmm. But this is 133 minutes, and there is not a wasted minute in there.
Nope.
Everything matters. The pace. I've often used this as the gold standard of superhero movie pacing. Mm-hmm. Is whenever I see a movie that feels like it just loses itself a little bit in the middle, I'm like, man, it needs to get on that X2 pace because it's so efficient. They introduce a lot of characters here. We are introduced to Nightcrawler here. We're introduced to William Stryker and his son in this movie.
Jason.
We are introduced to these new characters.
Oh, the Nightcrawler sequence I didn't even mention. My God.
God almighty. Alan Cumming is Nightcrawler. That sequence, for a long time, that was sort of the gold standard for CGI in a superhero movie.
You want to talk about like setting, like making a statement in the opening scene of your film.
Mm-hmm.
Good God. Good Lord. Does this movie
good
do it or what?
Lord. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the great opening scenes in any superhero movie. To this day, it holds up. This Nightcrawler sequence, it may never be topped for that character. And instantly, it's sending you a message of this movie is going to be operating at a breakneck pace, much higher pace than the first movie. It's almost like, you know, they got the first match in the series out of the way to sort of feel each other out, and now we're going to go balls to the wall for the rematch.
And they do.
And we get appearances from Robert Kelly of via Mystique, mm-hmm. which is a nice touch. Mystique gets some great scenes in this movie. Mm-hmm. The scene in the bar where she seduces the guy into the bathroom.
Oh yeah,
and then kills him.
No, she doesn't kill him.
Or that's right. No, she poisons him, right?
No, she injects extra iron into his blood.
The iron in his blood, which leads to the outstanding Magneto escape sequence mm-hmm. from the prison, where he looks like he's conducting a symphony. He's so calm mm-hmm. and just arrogant. The arrogance of Ian McKellen's Magneto is magnifique. Alan Cumming as Nightcrawler is sensational throughout the entire movie, making me care about that character like I did when I first encountered him in the cartoon. We get all of your typical X-Men soap opera drama you would expect with Rogue and Iceman. Pyro as well has a great arc in here. What about the sequence when Wolverine, they go to a Pyro or Iceman's house, family house, and goes outside and Wolverine gets shot in the head, and then the bullet gets expunged from his head as his healing factor kicks in?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Amazing. As that pops out and he sits up and cracks his neck and you just know shit's on. Lady Deathstrike has to get introduced to this movie. There's so many new characters that get introduced here, and yet the movie never takes a breath. And I don't mean that as negative. That's a positive, because it does have slow scenes where the characters are talking and the characters are developing themselves, but it's always in the service of something. There's always a point to every single scene. There's nothing superfluous here.
No.
Everything matters. Everything counts. The action is sensational throughout the entire movie. The Lady Deathstrike versus Wolverine fight, awesome. The hateable nature of William Stryker, who's just such a great heel, played by Brian Cox, who's a very versatile actor anyway. The arc of Cyclops and Jean in this movie, Storm's relationship with Nightcrawler is something that always stands out to me when I rewatch this movie, because it's one that I forget about because there's so many flashier things in it. But this Storm is kind of cynical. She's kind of over the whole peace between mutants and humans thing, and Nightcrawler gets her to sort of rediscover her humanity over the course of this movie. And it's just such a tour de force movie. I love it to this day. I think it's one of the gold standards in superhero storytelling. It and Days of Future Past are in this tier together to me, where they're, along with the Deadpool movies, where they're so great, I would not change anything about them. But X2, I think, just because every time I watch it, I can't take my eyes off of it. Mm-hmm. I just can't stop watching it. It's always going to hold up for me. So that's why it's my number two film. So Nick, let us hear yours.
My number two, as you talked about a little earlier, is X-Men Days of Future Past. You mentioned how walking out of the theater, you knew that these X2 and Days of Future Past were cut above. And for me, walking out, I thought instantly it was my favorite X-Men movie I had seen to date. And the reason was, we talked about this, you know, throughout the process of getting ready for this movie to come out. How in the hell can they pull this off? There's no way this is going to work. This is like this is a beloved comic book storyline, but it's beloved by comic book fans who are willing to go places with you that general audiences might not be. How are they going to sell this? How is this all going to work? How is it going to hold together? And yet, if you think about it, one of the things that for better or worse kind of defines the X-Men as a concept in the modern era anyway is a somewhat convoluted timeline. And so I think there's a certain charm in the idea of the movie universe doing
that.
There
are certain friends of ours that might take offense, Jeremy Reynolds,
yes,
to us saying that it's convoluted. Convoluted. But it is.
It is, yeah. But I think there's a charm in trying to bring an aspect of that into your movie universe. You obviously don't want to get into the, you know, the Summers family tree or the Madeline Pryors of it all, but like, you know, this movie is as unconvoluted a convoluted timeline as you could possibly do, if that makes any sense. I think it is the perfect amount of timeline wonkiness. I think the complex narrative that they have to pull off in this movie, and yet it all holds together, is a remarkable accomplishment from a sheer, like, plotting and scripting and storytelling standpoint. And that's before you ever get into any of the discussion about the action sequences, which there are outstanding action sequences in this movie. The blink sequence that you referred to a little bit earlier, the Quicksilver sequence, because we see him for the first time in this film. The fight sequence near the end, all the Sentinel stuff in the future is just remarkable. And then add into that, arguably the best performances of any X-Men movie from top to bottom, whether it is Hugh Jackman kind of doing one last big ensemble piece as kind of that classic version of Wolverine that we know, and really getting to play two different versions of Logan in the same movie with the mental swaps and stuff, whether it's getting to see Ellen Page come back, who was underutilized as Kitty Pryde, but is very good in this movie, whether it's Patrick Stewart, which what we thought at the time was going to be his last hurrah as Charles Xavier, giving an outstanding performance, Michael Fassbender and Ian McKellen both doing great portrayals of Magneto, Jennifer Lawrence, as you mentioned, Nicholas Holt, the original cast, Halle Berry being back, so many great performances. But the one I really want to shout out, James McAvoy. I know I said earlier that Apocalypse was his best performance, but I was wrong. I kind of got that mixed up a little bit. James McAvoy, as much as X-Men First Class is kind of dominated by Michael Fassbender, how he kind of steals the movie,
right,
I think McAvoy steals this movie. And it's really remarkable because Xavier is a character who I would agree is essential to the X-Men, but he's not really the most interesting character to have stories focus on, in my opinion. The stories I have read He's kind of the focus kind of lose me a little bit. And yet this one, you could argue, he and Wolverine are the two co-leads of this movie, and he just is this broken, bitter, disillusioned version of Charles Xavier. Absolutely works for me. They humanize this character a little bit, and it makes it to where you can understand his motivations much more clearly. And that one scene you get of him communing kind of with his future self, and you get Patrick Stewart basically telling his younger self in James McAvoy to stop wallowing in his own self-pity and get up off the ground and do something about it, is just outstanding. Arguably, I would put this McAvoy performance up there with any other performance in the X-Men universe outside of two that we're just about to talk about here in a minute. But it really is remarkable. In terms of the conventional X-Men movies, this is, for me, a clear winner. This and X2, they kind of occupy this next to last tier for me, this next to the top tier.
Rarefied air,
but I do think there's even like a little cut. This is a cut above X2, in my opinion. And I recently, probably 6 months ago, finally watched the Rogue Cut. Outstanding. If you love this movie, do yourself a favor, go out and watch the Rogue Cut. I won't say it makes the movie better, but it is a new way of experiencing the film and getting to see more characters that you know and love back with a little bit more screen time.
Excellent. I've got to watch that still. I never have. I guess when we made this list, when we talked about doing this subject over the weekend, we said we didn't know we'd have quite a similar list as we did, but we knew we would probably have the same movie at the bottom, and we knew we would definitely have the same movie at the top. That one thing we talked about, I was like, it's a foregone conclusion what the number one best X-Men movie is, because it's not just the best X-Men movie by a wide margin. It is also, and that's no knock on any of the other great movies, but this is a different level, guys. This is Dark Knight territory for me. This is Dark Knight Rises territory for me. So, Endgame territory for me. Yes. So, the number one
this
movie
is the
on this
only
list.
X-Men movie that I think, like, I would put in my top five superhero movies of all time.
Agreed. Agreed completely.
There is nothing else that has been made like it.
And we may never see anything like it again.
And we kind of, I would argue we probably shouldn't. Like, because Dark Phoenix, which is about to come out next week, and you know, it very well could wind up being a good film, right? We're going to go watch it. But I think you and I would both agree that coming into it, that storyline does not feel earned with this cast yet.
Right.
This movie we're about to talk about, everything that happens feels earned to me.
This had been earned over the course of about almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Almost 20 years that we had that they had been building to this movie, and whether we didn't realize it, but once you see the movie, you realize that this is a two-decade in the making. It only works if you have the prior context of Wolverine, what we've seen in these movies that we've talked about to this point, all these other movies in this franchise. The movie is Logan, 2017, by director James Mangold. It is a masterpiece. It is a movie that we talk about. It used to be used condescendingly, but it truly, in this case, I don't mean it condescendingly, but it defies the genre. It moves beyond a superhero film. It is it's a statement movie from James Mangold. It's a statement movie from Hugh Jackman, even more pointedly. And, you know, I was doing some research on this, Nick, the reasons why this movie succeeds are countless, and we'll talk about some of them here. But the screenplay was written by James Mangold, mm-hmm. who is a director that I think we all know has done great movies. He did The Wolverine, which was a great movie. He's done Walk the Line, 3:10 to Yuma, Girl Interrupted, Copland, just a few of his great movies. But it was also written by these two guys, Scott Frank and Michael Green, along with James Mangold, are co-writers on this. Scott Frank's credits include being the screenwriter for Minority Report, Out of Sight, A Walk Among the Tombstones, so Heaven's Prisoners. So
what a filmography as a director from James Mangold. You go from Copland and Girl Interrupted to Kate and Leopold and Night and Day, which was just awful. Like, what an interesting filmmaker.
And then the other screenwriter is Michael Green, who's a comic book veteran that also wrote the scripts for, you're gonna be interested in this.
That name sounds awful familiar.
Michael Green was a co-writer, one of the 75 co-writers on Green Lantern.
On Green Lantern and Prometheus?
Alien Covenant.
Alien Covenant, yeah.
And wrote Blade Runner 2049.
Ah, which was awesome.
And Murder on the Orient Express, which I haven't seen yet. But yeah, so this is what I'm getting at is these are three incredibly talented film writers who are working on this movie together. And they're clearly simpatico. They are clearly on the same page. And I think when you get a great movie director in James Mangold, who has made great films, you give him complete creative control, which he clearly has here, and you get an actor, a star, not just an actor, but a star like Hugh Jackman, who commits to this character and to this role as if it is the last time, and it was the last time he ever has played this character. And this is a guy in Hugh Jackman, Nick, that we've talked about on this list a lot, mm-hmm. more than any other actor, that has given nothing but great performances in these movies, even in the bad movie, X-Men Origins Wolverine. But somehow, and I think you'd agree with this, Nick, he takes it to a different level here. Even looking at the I'm looking at the poster right now, and this is different, man. This is like, this is some Heath Ledger stuff here. This is a different level of performance from Jackman in this film, and he partners himself with another man who is making his swan song in the X-Men universe. And like you said a minute ago, we thought he was done with Days of Future Past, but Patrick Stewart returns as an older version of Charles Xavier, who is riddled with dementia and is clearly a man who is on the path to dying. And he gives what is by far his greatest performance in this franchise. I dare say his greatest performance in general. This movie is just, I run out of things to say about it, because it is a masterpiece that has to be watched. You have to watch this movie. I don't want to come off like some pretentious film critic talking about what a masterpiece it is, but truly, I don't know how anyone, if you have a human heart, can watch this film and not feel something, man. We talked about it with Endgame, the importance of the emotional response to these movies. Mm-hmm. We talked about it throughout our MCU podcast. Logan is a movie, and I'll be up front here. Logan is one of only two comic book movies that I can think of top of my head, maybe three, that ever actually made me cry during the course of the movie in the theater watching it. Like and it was a couple times. It wasn't just once.
Yeah.
I shed tears during this movie, and it's in the hand. I'll throw a handful in there because, you know, Dark Knight Rises, Endgame, you know.
Yeah. Those are the three.
Guardians 2 to an extent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Guardians 2. Yeah.
But like this, the reaction that I felt at the end of this movie was not unlike the feeling that I felt at the end of The Dark Knight Rises.
Except,
not as jubilant.
But yeah, I was about to say, but Dark Knight Rises,
yeah,
it punches you in the gut emotionally, and then it's like, and then it gives you a pat on the back as you're walking out of the theater. Mm-hmm. Like, okay.
Logan gives you no such pat on the back.
No such pat. Danielle and I went to see this together the night it came out, and I remember she hated it because she does not revel in emotional torture the way I do for whatever reason.
It was a tear fest. It was somber. And do you remember
walking out of the theater
and the silence,
dead silence, no one speaking? It. I loved that so much. That reaction to the movie. And
hands over mouths.
Right.
Hands on heads. Like, just, it was the fact that a superhero movie, a movie about a comic book character that I read when I was 5 years old,
a movie about a guy with metal claws who can magically heal himself,
can make you feel that.
Yes.
I mean, hell, I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. That's what it's all about, man. That's what this medium can do. That when it's earned and when it's right and when it's done with passion.
And, you know, you did such a great job of talking about Hugh Jackman. I mean, there's really nothing I have to add there outside of saying he's outstanding. But this movie makes you feel that, and I would argue it makes you feel that largely because of Logan's connection to primarily two supporting characters that we need to talk about.
Yes.
First being Daphne Keene as a young Lara slash the character we know in the comics as X-23, a clone of Logan who has spent her life in this facility where she's been experimented on, much like, you know, Logan can see the parallels to himself right there. And she loses her mother, or the woman who she believes to be her mother, fairly early on in the film. And she's kind of lost and looking for this family of people that she knew in the facility. And she has no direction, and she's wild, and she is impulsive, and she is all these things that Logan knows he used to be, and he is trying so hard to both protect her and guide her, all the while having to come to grips with the fact that he is becoming more and more mortal every day. This healing factor is only going to carry him along, you know, so far. And having to come to grips with his own mortality while he is trying to essentially be a surrogate father is just one of the most emotionally resonant storylines ever portrayed in a comic book film. That relationship between those two makes that ending hit so much harder. Mm. But I would argue none of this movie – the movie could have still been great if they had told a version of the story without this other performance. But it would not have achieved the level of legendary status that it does in my mind if not for the best portrayal of mental illness. One of the best I've ever seen put on screen, let alone a superhero film.
Yeah.
Patrick Stewart as a dementia-riddled Charles Xavier is revelatory. It is... I made the argument when the movie came out, as great as Hugh Jackman was, I thought Patrick Stewart was better. Just because I had... It's something that you... When you go to see a movie with the Marvel logo, whether it's Marvel, you know, comics or Marvel Studios attached to it, you do not expect to see something that is going to make you feel that the way this performance makes you feel. As someone who has had a grandparent who went through a similar experience, like, it is so... emotionally devastating, and it's emotionally devastating again because they have earned that emotional investment from mm-hmm. you over the course of God. This movie came out in what, 16, 17? I don't remember.
2017.
Yeah. So 17 years. Played for laughs at times. We get, you know, there are moments.
Fuck off, Logan.
Fuck off, Logan. Taco Bell. you know, moments where the old Charles Xavier shines through, and then there are moments where. You can see that Logan is losing the closest thing to a father he ever had. So he is gaining and losing family throughout this movie.
He's a man who's lost everything, and he's about to lose even more. And he's keeping him around because he doesn't want to lose him, but he's losing him whether he wants to or not.
Right, and he's desperately holding on to this one last thing he has. And yeah, I mean, those two supporting performances combined. With Hugh Jackman's lead performance combined with 2017 Eric LaSalle being in a movie, just all adds up to by far and away, hands down, the best Fox X film.
Absolutely. And it's one of those, you know, you keep waiting. I think the first time you see this movie, you're so absorbed in it, you're just watching. You're sucked into it, so you don't think about it. But I think if you're looking at it from an outsider's perspective, you might be watching this thinking, waiting for it to fall apart, waiting for something to happen, a flaw to come up, and it never happens. It never happens. The movie never falls apart. The movie sticks to the landing mm-hmm. with what I will say, at the risk of being hyperbolic, is the best death scene mm-hmm. in a superhero movie. And I don't think it'll ever be topped because I don't see how it could be. It's, you know, the scene where Logan, because it's not just a death scene. It's not just a hero making a sacrifice. It's Logan passing away and being content with that because now he realized that line about, you know, he finally has found his family. Mm-hmm. And that the scene of him holding, Laura's hand, Daphne Keene, we haven't talked about enough. She is amazing in this movie. I never gave a single crap about X-23 until this movie. She is fantastic, and I pray that we get a chance to see her play this character again, maybe in the MCU, because she helps this movie. If she was bad, if she was a mediocre child actor, this movie doesn't work nearly as well as it does.
Absolutely.
She's great. Everybody in this movie is great. And the three leads, as you put it, Daphne Keene, Hugh Jackman, and Patrick Stewart put in all-time great performances that makes this a movie that is one, not just one of my top comic book movies. It's in my top five favorite movies that I've ever seen. Yes. So that being said, those are our list, folks. Should we recount them one more time?
Yeah,
I did. This has been a long one.
Real quick, starting from the bottom, and I'll go – there we have identical beginnings to our list. We at number 11 we have X-Men Origins X-Men Origins Wolverine. At 10 we have X-Men The Last Stand. At 9 we have X-Men First Class. At 8 we have X-Men Apocalypse. At 7 we have X-Men, and at 6 we have The Wolverine. And I think even we both had Deadpool at 5.
That's right.
Deadpool at 5. So we don't diverge at all until we get to number 4. So I'll go first with my top 4. My top 4 were Deadpool 2 at 4, X2 at 3, Days of Future Past at 2, and Logan at number 1.
And I had Days of Future Past at 4, Deadpool 2 at 3, X2 at 2, and Logan at 1. Well, with that being said, Nick already told you how to reach out to us on Twitter and Facebook and email to let us know your list, your rankings, your thoughts and memories of these movies. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have reading, watching, and the rundown, among others.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. In the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We have gotten through the countdown, and we are ready to introduce you to the news and notes in the world of comics. It's a segment.
Wait. But first, Greg.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes, yes. My mistake.
Not like we just discussed this or anything in the
yes,
break.
Yes, we literally just discussed it, and it slipped my mind. Mm-hmm. We indeed have some exciting announcements about some of the shows here at Place to Be Nation.
We do, starting with the Place to Be Nation pop feed, where we have a little bit of something for everyone. After a 2-year hiatus, Daddy Cast is back, and JT and Don talk a variety of annoyances, including potty training, lying, Nickelodeon shows, and more. Meanwhile, Russell and Sam deliver their season 1 finale of 90 to Nothing with a look at Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. On Year in Pop, hosts Andy and Scott are joined by D'Amato and Dr. G to discuss the news, music, and movies of 1975. My lord. A podcast after Jeremy Reynolds' own heart. Pop goes to the movies with Andy Atherton's review of the new live-action Aladdin. Mm-hmm. The hard-traveling fanboys had Avengers Month, and we already talked about all that. That's over now. The NBA team dropped a double shot of episodes, including Gone Fishing Part 1 and an NBA Finals preview pod blast, which you should definitely listen to the preview now that we're 4 games into the NBA Finals. And finally, This Week in Sports also found the Cowboy and D'Amato running down the NBA Finals and breaking down the series between the Warriors and Raptors, which you should go ahead and listen to again, because by the time you hear this, we'll be 5 games into the Finals by this point, which is a great time to listen to a preview. Be sure to keep out an eye on our social media feeds as the reboot of the Greatest Song of the 80s tournament is starting soon. Russian bots, beware.
That's right. Keep your asses in Kiev.
That's
over
the
at the PTBN wrestling feed on the Place to Be podcast, Justin Scott and not Justin Scott, but Justin, Scott and guest Jake Williams dive into the May 1989 Meadowlands House Show in episode 521. Then they are right back with a double dose of Saturday night's main event from May and July of 1989 with guest Peter Winson, fond of the state of Missouri. In the 6th episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zani welcomes Daniel Maccabe to talk music and his independent wrestling career. Scott Criscolo, Nate Milton, and Steve Willey recap Double or Nothing and Classic TNA on the newest edition of Main Event. On PlaceToBeNation.com, don't forget to check out Steve Riddle's countdown of the top 25 matches in TakeOver history. Just had another one this past weekend that had a couple matches that might make that list if we were to do it now. Also available on the site is the latest installment of PTBN's excellent WWE Network Adventure with an in-depth look at Mid-South Wrestling from 5/26/1984. I think we have a man in the studio here, Nick, that will be particularly excited about that.
Quite frankly.
Check out our social media pages and message board at bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our greatest WWE PPV and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list. Well, with that out of the way, now we are ready to get to the news, PN news, and notes in the world of comics. Well,
welcome to the rundown.
We're not going to have nearly as long a rundown as we did last week, Nick. Or the last time we did a live rundown. But we do need to follow up because Tom King is in the news again.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of news stories about Mr. Tom King here,
yes.
Nick. First of it, which is that he is going to get a chance, as it turns out, to finish his Batman story that he had going on in the title, Batman.
A little bit abbreviated, as we understand it. I think the number is roughly, it's being cut from, I think, 20 more issues after 85 that he had planned down to 12. So he's got to condense it a bit, but I think you would argue that's probably a good thing.
That's probably a good thing. And they might have a higher page count on this.
We don't know.
Anyway, DC has confirmed that Tom King will depart Batman after, what is it, issue 85?
85, yes, the 85. Conclusion of City of Bane, as I understand it.
And then in January of 2020, they will debut, DC that is, a 12-issue miniseries titled Batman / Catwoman. Mm-hmm. And hopefully emphasis on the slash.
Mm.
Drawn by tremendous artist Clay Mann, and that will be a 12-issue miniseries debuting January 2020. Here's the quote from embattled editor-in-chief Bob Harris.
Mm.
We're making changes to our comic book publishing line to set DC up for continued success. We're starting with the best-selling Batman comic after City of Bane wraps up in December. City of Bane is an incredible story and an integral part of our overall Year of the Villain campaign, and a new Tom King and Clay Mann Bat-Cat series in 2020 fills the gap once Batman begins to ship monthly. DC does emphasize that Batman will revert from its twice-monthly shipping back to monthly issues come January 2020. Interesting, Nick. I didn't see that anywhere else. So Batman's going back to monthly, and we're getting the Batman Catwoman book as a 12-issue monthly. King says this will be the biggest, most ambitious project of his career. And, so he's excited about it. I'm excited about it. Believe it or not, Nick, I'm actually excited about this. And let me tell you why.
Because Tom King can go off into a corner where you can mostly ignore him.
No, I'll get to that in just a minute. I'm excited about this because Batman and Catwoman is one of my favorite relationships in comics, mm-hmm. and I genuinely think there should be a Batman and a title, whether it's the main Batman title or elsewhere, where Batman and Catwoman are in a relationship and exploring that relationship, and we get to see their partnership. I think that's great. So I think there's a chance this could be good. The best parts to me of Tom King's Batman run, from what I read, were Batman and Catwoman interacting with one another, even if I hate their nicknames for one another. And the worst parts of Tom King's Batman run, from what I read, were everything else. So I'm good with this. I think he's good dealing with these two characters interacting with one another. So this could actually turn out for the best for DC Comics. I think Batman fans will be happy because if they don't want to read Tom King's Batman, well, guess what? They're going to save some money because they only have to buy Batman once a month now. So, I think it works out for everybody. If it sucks, you can, as you put it away to the corner and ignore it and get somebody else's vision on the main title, which they need to carry their brand. So, yes, I think this is all good news across the board. Nick, what about you?
I think it's the best possible news that we could have gotten after the initial reporting. Tom King even says, I mean, in the quote that DC puts out, that he's not that it does pain him to leave Batman. So I still am of the belief that if you got his honest opinion, if he were doing the Talk is Jericho post DC departure podcast, he would admit that this was not his decision and that he probably is at least a little bit upset by it. But it could be far worse. He could have been essentially shit canned with no planned conclusion. I'm still interested. I'm interested to see how much of this conclusion differs from his original idea, and that's something we probably won't know for years because he probably won't talk about it until we've got some separation from it. So, the promise was big landscape shifting things were coming to the character of Batman.
Will DC even pay attention to what happens?
Yeah, I think they either won't happen at all, or DC will summarily ignore them. So, we'll see how it turns out.
We will. We'll have to see. But it's also more good news coming for Tom King. He's going to get to finish his story for the most part in his comics. And he has now been confirmed to be working with Ava DuVernay on writing the New Gods movie.
Hey, this is cool. This is pretty cool, actually. I've not read Mr. Miracle yet, but Tom King's Mr. Miracle has been pretty universally regarded as an outstanding comic book from the last couple of years. I know it's been nominated for some Eisners. It's right up there with it. I think his Vision work was also heavily critically acclaimed over at Marvel. So have not checked this out. But, I mean, if you're looking for somebody who has just recently told a damn good New God story, this seems like the place to start, does it not?
Right. Well, it's also indicative, to my knowledge, Nick, you have to help me. I mean, yeah, Geoff Johns to a degree, but this is maybe the first time I can remember a comic book writer being called on by a movie studio or a director to directly write the screenplay for a comic book film.
Yeah.
At least of the big two, you know?
Yeah, Bendis was attached to that Kitty Pryde movie a couple of years ago that obviously never wound up happening because of Fox Disney reasons.
Yep.
But in terms of movies that, I mean, at this point, I think you and I both think this is probably going to see the light of day at some point. So, yeah, this is pretty unprecedented. And
maybe it's a sign that we could see guys like Geoff Johns, yeah, Scott Snyder, Bendis and others get a hand in writing some of these movies.
Well, Geoff in particular, whenever he left his editorial position at DC, one of the things he said he was going to work on is the script for that Green Lantern movie. So, you know.
Which I'm not convinced ever sees the light of day.
I'm not either. Which sucks. But, yeah, this sounds cool. I guess we'll have to pick up maybe that Mr. Miracle for a long book at some point.
Right, agreed. But the other thing about this is I'm also uber excited about this, Nick, because this gives yet another thing to keep Tom King's time occupied. So maybe he won't touch any of my beloved characters.
I hope we essentially get a character swap where Bendis comes over to write Batman and they give Tom King Superman.
Oh, my God. That's and, you know, a lot of people probably say he'd probably write a good Superman. And he might. Then again, he wrote a good Superman story in Action, I think Action 1000, right?
And he did the Superman story for that for the Walmart giant-sized, the 100-page specials that apparently pissed a lot of people off because it was
–
the premise of it was Superman imagining all the different ways that Lois Lane could die, except you actually saw it on panel. So you saw Lois Lane die these terrible deaths like over and over again, so it – A lot of people took offense to it.
Oh, well. I don't mind that. But I don't remember if his Superman story was good or not, honestly, in the Action 1000. But, you know, he might do something that just fundamentally breaks the character – or not breaks the character, but makes the character boring and uninteresting like he's done with Batman. To me. So we'll have to see how that all plays out. But I'm excited. Just so long as I don't have to deal with him handling any changes to another Titans era character, I'll be good.
Do you really believe that was like that he was the one out there campaigning for Dick Grayson to get shot in the head? Do you truly believe that?
I believe that.
You don't believe it. Don't you know who that was?
I believe he was complicit in it.
He was complicit in it in as much as like God,
he wrote the idiotic way that it happened.
If not for Geoff Johns, everybody else would have been complicit in it during Infinite Crisis. Like,
right, but you know, I think that he wanted to do these seismic shift changes to the Batman family,
that.
And I think that in this case, that entailed violent changes to Dick Grayson, and that was on from on high, but also one that he was fine doing and thought was an interesting direction. It is not an interesting direction, for the record. And I don't think that he was the one that necessarily wanted Wally West killed off either, but he did it. He wrote his story, and
yeah, you know, he even gave a quote about Heroes in Crisis recently where he said that the pitch for it was he just told DC the story that he wanted to tell, and they gave him the characters, apparently. So.
Well, that tracks. That tracks, because I feel like his handling of some of these classic characters has not been great. And I shouldn't say that because I haven't read Heroes in Crisis. Maybe I'll read it and love it. I highly doubt it. But
listen, yeah. I am as big a fan of depressing comic book stories as anyone, and I'm not really a Wally West fan, and I have no interest in reading a Wally West story that does the things I understand Heroes in Crisis to do with that character.
Yeah. Well. It's not all sunshine and roses, needless to say, for DC Comics. Because,
no, it is not.
One of the most beloved imprints in all of comics, arguably the most beloved imprint.
In terms of just imprints, yeah. I mean, if you don't count DC Comics or Marvel as an imprint, and taking my own personal bias towards the Ultimate imprint out of it, this is the most notable, most prominent, most beloved imprint in comics history.
Bleeding Cool has been informed by a number of sources that DC Comics is planning to shutter its Vertigo imprint.
Awful.
This is not the first time that this has been rumored, but it looks like it's actually going to happen this time. They had just greenlit a number of Vertigo projects, again, according to Rich Johnston of Bleeding Cool, so who knows for sure, but he's got a pretty good track record on this stuff.
Especially recently.
There were a number of Vertigo projects greenlit. Big plan to launch them at San Diego Comic-Con. But now there are many changes afoot as a result of the decision from on high, quote, to shut down the imprint, which is responsible for some of the most popular DC Comics stories of all time, including Sandman, Preacher, 100 Bullets, mm-hmm. Why the Last Man, Transmetropolitan, and Fables.
Didn't Swamp Thing eventually wind up as a Vertigo title?
I think only retroactively.
Okay, retroactively, think, yeah.
Because
Green Arrow never was. Green Arrow was...
Right.
The Mike Grell Green Arrow was responsible for helping to justify the existence of a Vertigo line, but to my knowledge, it has never been directly marketed as a Vertigo title.
Right, and in Vertigo, I think, was a 90s creation.
1993, anyway. I believe.
Yeah, so we also got Hellblazer.
Was a
Vertigo title. iZombie, versions of the Doom Patrol, versions of Swamp Thing.
We could go on. I mean, the list of titles is legendary.
Creator-owned inspired titles that were different, that were independent, that were... avant-garde at times, pushing the medium forward. Creators like Grant Morrison, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman.
Typically?
Yes, absolutely. Brian K. Vaughan, that changed the comic book medium for the better. It kind of became what Image Comics is now is what Vertigo was in the 90s.
Except owned and operated by one of the big two.
Exactly.
I haven't looked at a physical copy of this book in a long time. Do they now market Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on a Serious Earth as a Vertigo title?
I don't know. They do market Watchmen as it.
Yes. Which makes sense.
Or have.
You know.
And V for Vendetta as well.
Uh-huh. I think the copy of V for Vendetta I own has the Vertigo marking on the spine, so.
Apparently their 2018 relaunch fizzled out, did not do well, and
well,
the company
I have...
overly reactionary, as it often is.
Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, the 2018 relaunch fizzled out because, if you remember, they announced the relaunch, and then 3 months, like it was something like 3 or 4 months later, they announced Black Label, and all these books that would have been perfect Vertigo titles, they were giving them to Black Label. Like,
yep, they canceled Second Coming over content concerns, if you recall.
But wasn't that a Black Label title?
I believe that it was going to be a Vertigo title.
Yeah. So, I mean, just all these things that just... I gotta be honest. Like, from a business standpoint, I can kind of understand, because as much as we love Vertigo, the idea of it, I think financially it probably hasn't been what it once was for some time now.
Mm-hmm.
So if this were happening in a vacuum, I don't know that it would bum me out as much as it is today. But it's bumming me out for a number of reasons. You have to take this and combine this bit of news with what's been going on for the last, what, Greg, 18 months or so over at DC Comics. Pretty much since the AT&T sale got ready to come through, with AT&T acquiring Time Warner and thus acquiring DC Comics. When this goes down, we're in the midst of rebirth. You and I both were in agreement that you can make the case for DC Comics creatively being as hot as it had been in 15 years, at least from a line-wide superhero main universe perspective.
Yep.
This sale gets ready to come down. Geoff Johns announces that he is stepping down as chief creative officer and is going to move on to start his own production company. He's still going to write some books, but editorially speaking, in terms of being in the office day-to-day, he is relinquishing that responsibility. And you and I both at the time, we were excited, but we were also apprehensive. Mm-hmm. And that apprehension has bore out over the last 18 months or so with a creative direction that you can almost pinpoint. Maybe it's me being a fanboy. Maybe I'm biased. I'll admit to all those things. But I feel like you can. Good God, what is that noise?
Just a thing falling in my floor.
I think you can pinpoint him leaving with a sharp turn in the way DC Comics was handling its characters and its storylines and even its creators.
Yeah.
The era of hope and getting back to basics that Rebirth was all about has been thrown out. And in its place is a era of wild character shifts, doing shocking things with beloved characters, arguably losing the core of who these characters are. You throw into that the recent controversies over Tom King, his creative output, both the reputation of his Batman series within the fan community, the fan community's response, both positively and negatively, to the recent reporting surrounding his future with Batman, the fan community response to what occurred in the pages of Heroes in Crisis, the Black Label controversy of many Black Label titles, essentially being taken off table after they dared to show a penis in silhouette in the background of one panel that wasn't even the focus of the fucking image.
Oh!
And then now this, it feels like we are entering an era where oversight is not the word. Editorial interference is the word. And it is... You hesitate to want to be alarmist or extreme, but we brought this up in a group chat we had earlier. I am starting to worry that this AT&T thing is going to be the comic book equivalent of the AOL Time Warner merger and what that was for wrestling with WCW. Do I think that DC Comics is going to cease to exist? No. But I think the version of DC Comics that I have loved and recognized for the last 15 years, I feel like that's in danger.
Valid concerns, Nick. Valid concerns. It's hard for me to muster the energy to even care about this as much as I once did because of what you've outlined. The feeling of having been burned, right?
Yeah.
Like we had so many expectations, and not just expectations, but quality output. We were enjoying ourselves as comic book fans on an unprecedented level for DC. For me personally, it was the most comics that I have ever pulled in my life was 2016. I was given everything under the sun a shot, and most of it was landing with me. And then you fast forward 3 years, and I'm pulling zero book. Actually, I'm still getting Deathstroke just to complete it. I haven't read it in a year and a half, but just to complete the run, I'm pulling it. But like a year and a half later, and I'm pulling nothing except Doomsday Clock and Deathstroke, down from when I was pulling like, what, 15 comics at one point. So it's all from DC. It's disappointing. So we'll have to see where they go from here and where the, how the company adjusts, hopefully adjusts moving forward. But this is certainly a disappointment, and I hope that we don't see the same destruction, self-destruction, as a result of this merger that we did see with that AOL Time Warner merger that directly led to the ending of an era in the wrestling business that was unquestionably for the worse for wrestling fans. And then also, you know, as a, the decline of the Atlanta Braves for the better part of a decade. So, we'll have to see how it plays out. And also other bad news, Nick, you know, we reviewed a comic book here on this show not too long ago on the Long Book Hunters, from a WWE comic book series that had been running for some time from Boom Studios, but that is coming to an end. After 25 issues, Boom Studios announced that the WWE series, written by Dennis Hopeless, is coming to an end. It's unknown if it was a mutual deal or if the book was canceled due to low sales. No one really knows, but it's coming to an end, and that's the end of that.
Yep, that sucks.
Indeed. And Marvel, over on the Marvel side of things, they have announced that they are bringing audiobooks in order to bring classic Marvel stories to a new medium. Marvel Comics and Dreamscape Media will produce a series of audiobooks based on classic Marvel stories. These stories mentioned here include Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate X-Men, X-Men Codename Wolverine, and the Frank Miller story, Daredevil, The Man Without Fear. I know audiobooks are a big thing for you, Nick. You're a big fan of those, particularly those radio dramas that we keep talking about doing on one
it's
of our
shows. It's just the time commitment that we have to figure out. Right. We have to wrap our heads around the way to make that digestible at some point. But, yeah. No, this is exciting. It's particularly the use of the word ultimate already has me very excited. And then you throw in an adaptation of Man Without Fear. I'm all for this. Now, I did go on to read that some of these are also going to be based on some novelizations that were written as far back as the 70s. And so those should be interesting, if probably not good, you know, from a narrative standpoint. But more audio content, I'm kind of in on this audio superhero thing. You know, Stitcher recently did they're in the second season of that Wolverine audio drama podcast they're doing, which I think is a cool thing. So, more of this, more ways to consume superhero media. I'm all for it. Mm-hmm.
Well, another version of superhero media is the motion picture, and 20th Century Fox, or is it 21st Century Fox? Who the hell knows? Their embattled New Mutants film, which has been rescheduled multiple times since originally being scheduled for an April 18 theatrical release, now scheduled to arrive in April 2020. And Simon Kinberg, the producer, has explained the delays on the film in regards to the reshoots that are planned, or as he calls them, pickups. He says, we do them on all of these movies. We haven't had a chance to do the pickups on New Mutants, largely because it's a cast of actors that almost all of them are on television shows.
Uh-huh.
Getting them all together again at the same time and at the same place has proven difficult.
Right.
But I think we figured out a way to do it this year so that the movie will be ready in time for the new release date.
So they couldn't figure out this cast of seven for New Mutants, and yet Marvel could figure out the cast of literally like 40 for Endgame.
Ah, it's interesting you should mention that. Because as it turns out, the X-Men movies don't plan reshoots into their filming schedule.
Oh my God.
Quote, with the Avengers movies, there are inevitably pickups you do when you are making the movie. You build it into the budget and the schedule. They know exactly when they are going to do it. On the Fox Marvel movies, we have never done that. We probably should have, because it just makes life easier. Getting this kind of cast all at the same place at the same time is not an easy thing to do. They go off and they have other things going on.
Can we just agree to call this entire quote bullshit? It's bullshit. Like the reshoots haven't happened because Fox didn't care enough to make them happen. and they weren't sure that Disney was going to care until very recently. And I'm still not sure to what degree Disney actually cares. So, like, if this movie was a priority, they would have happened by now. Yes, these people did other projects and stuff. The example they used of Maisie Williams, though, there was like a 2.5-year gap between seasons of Game of Thrones. It's not a valid excuse. Fuck off with that.
Well, another thing that's happening, at least after his sojourn from Hollywood that he is currently taking, mm-hmm. Chris Hemsworth has confirmed that he would like very much to continue playing Thor and to do so in James Gunn's Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. It says here in this here article that I'm just now scrolling down that Hemsworth says, quote, I'd play that character again. I love it so much, especially if there's something unique to do again with it. I felt like the last three films were very, very different each time. It really felt like a totally different character. Despite his enthusiasm, he has not yet signed a deal to take up the mantle of the God of Thunder again. However, he is identified as Guardians of the Galaxy as a potential landing spot for him. He says he doesn't know if they're shooting in the movie yet, or when or if they're shooting it, but he says right now he's kind of buried his head in the sand, but he'll work with any of those guys. As Guardians of the Galaxy sounds great to him. He says to the interviewer, you might have just got me my next job. So this all sounds great to me, Nick. Make it happen.
Absolutely.
Sign me up. And here's one that you added to the list here today that is rather unique. Quentin Tarantino's
technically comic book related. I'm standing by it.
Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained is getting a comic book crossover with Zorro.
No, he already got the comic book crossover.
Ah, I'm sorry. Yes, the comic book already happened. Now, writer Jared Carmichael has signed on to adapt a 2014 Django Zorro crossover comic into a feature film. It was the original crossover was a sequel to Django Unchained with a plot by Tarantino, script by Matt Wagner, and drawn by Estev Poles. And do you think Quentin Tarantino would even be remotely interested in directing this?
Probably not. But you know, I love Django Unchained so much that I don't really care. Like, maybe it will be bad, but this sounds awesome. And you know, this is my first. Let me offer a little storytelling suggestion for these guys. I haven't read this tie-in comic, but if it's gonna come from the world of comics, I think you should take one of the great tropes of the comic book genre and bring a character back from the dead. That's right. I think Django and Zorro should have to face off against an undead version of Samuel L. Jackson as Steven from the first film.
Well, wrapping up our news and notes.
Wait a minute. No thoughts on this, Greg?
I mean, it would be entertaining as hell. I would want Tarantino involved in it, but it would be entertaining as hell, no question. What do you think that they'll get Antonio Banderas to reprise his role as Zorro from the 90s?
I'd be for it. Hey, the bottom of the story actually says no studio is confirmed to be involved at this juncture. However, leaked emails from the 2014 Sony hack, back when apparently this comic book crossover was first being formed, revealed that Tarantino had been involved in talks with the studio about a film adaptation. So maybe not directing, but involved in some capacity, perhaps.
Maybe so. And that was also, I believe, when your leaked photos came out, right?
My leaked photos?
Yeah.
What were they? What photos?
Leaked photos of, you know, you and your Friday afternoon work suit.
Oh, man. The ass dimples. The Rikishi-like ass dimples.
Well, the last item here is one that is near and dear to your heart in particular.
Yes.
Jessica Jones Season 3, the final season of this show, got its first teaser released to the internet.
Looks good.
Not a lot revealed, obviously, but nonetheless, good to see the Kristen Ritter and company ready and raring to go.
And there's a synopsis that also came out for it that I don't want to read because I don't think you've seen season two yet.
No.
Yeah, I don't want to read that, but it is – the synopsis is exactly what I want this wanted this season to be after season two. And if they're setting it up as a rivalry between these two characters, I hope Jessica brutally murders this other character by the end of the season.
Very, very, very good. I think I know who you're referring to, because, and I think it's because you would find that to be particularly stratifying.
Parker!
With that being said, that
sanctimonious
is the,
self-righteousness. Fuck off that shit.
That is the end of the news and notes on the rundown. That means it's time to get into reading and watching. And I'm actually going to.
we have something unprecedented for this segment.
Shock people.
We should do. We should leave a gap for the jingle. That's time for reading and watching. Pause.
Reading and watching.
Now continue.
And folks, are you ready?
Yep. Drum roll, please. Spotlight, please.
We actually have a reading.
We do. Both of us.
We have read a comic book, an American comic book.
I read four American comic books. Four comic books this week.
That's right. Doomsday Clock number 10
yep.
came out this past week. I have read it.
I have as well. I got caught up. I read 7, 8, 9, and 10 all in like a night. Or not, no, I read like two the night before and then two the next morning. So I'm caught up as well. Greg's already talked about 7, 8, 9, so I won't bore you with my thoughts there. We'll just jump straight to 10.
Gary Frank is the artist on this one, of course. Jeff Johns, they're much maligned for the delays in this comic, but whoo boy, as all of that cynicism that I was talking about comics, which is still there, don't get me wrong. I still have a great deal of cynicism right now about the comic book industry.
And I would argue after reading this, you could say that so does Jeff Johns.
Yeah, which is kind of unfortunate when you think about a guy that's so passionate about comics and mm-hmm. the level of vitriol that comes through at times on these pages for the decision makers in the comic book world. A few in particular we can think of probably. But at the same time, reading this comic, I was gripped. I haven't picked up a physical comic book since the last time Doomsday Clock came out, which has been a long ass time. And so,
which was 4 score and 7 years ago at this
case. Yes. And as I sat down this past weekend, Nick, to start reading this, I could not put it down. This was a masterpiece comic. I used that word earlier to describe Logan. This comic was sensational. Todd and Russell had both independently built it up to me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I got to get on reading this. And I read mm-hmm. it, man. And I was freaking blown away. Everything – I don't want to spoil it necessarily for people that haven't read it yet, but – fans of the Justice Society, fans of classic DC continuity,
who were fans of the DC Universe Rebirth special, because
yep.
Doomsday Clock as a whole has been pitched as the sequel, the sort of sequel to or follow up mm-hmm. to Rebirth, you know, the Rebirth special number one. This issue in particular feels like Jeff Johns picking up where Rebirth left off, not narratively, mm-hmm. but from the metatextual view of what he had to say in Rebirth about the state of both the comics industry and more specifically DC Comics. Mm-hmm. Those themes and ideas are picked up a few years later here, and we kind of get the impression we're checking back in with what Jeff thinks of what's going on right now.
The rant, it's so weird that it's so kind of serendipitous that the rant that you just went on a few minutes ago about DC and your trepidations and fears kind of comes through in this comic. This feels like a repudiation of everything that has been going on in the comic book industry for a number of years.
Yep. And you know, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
It's difficult to describe my thoughts on this. I love the book also. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I think I would love it to the degree that you loved it if I weren't so preoccupied with what DC Comics is. What I mean by that is, let's say Rebirth comes out, and let's say we get Doomsday Clock starts like 6 months later, and it comes out on time. So let's say we're getting this book like in the midst of Rebirth, and Jeff Johns is still an editorial influence at DC Comics. And we are, in that context, being led to believe that this is a statement, a manifesto on not just, you know, the way comics have been produced at DC, but the way they're going to be produced going forward. Think about how excited we would be.
Yeah.
And now think about the fact that I don't think either one of us really expects this to have long-term, long-reaching impact anymore the way it was once slated to. And that sucks. The story still matters. Don't get me wrong. The story is still great. It's still an outstanding story. But for an issue that delivers a shot across the bow of DC editorial, it just sucks that shot isn't being delivered from inside the ship anymore. You know what I mean? It sucks that change can't be manifested from the inside anymore. And I honestly don't believe that change is coming.
I don't either. And I hope we're wrong about that. I hope that this does have the lasting impacts that it was meant to have, I think, moving forward. But again, I'm like you. I don't think so. But regardless, the story's amazing. If you're a longtime fan of comic, if you ever felt any kind of negativity about the New 52 and the direction that some of the characters took in the aftermath, Superman in particular, you owe it to yourself to read this entire series, but also this issue. It's been a great series to this point. To me, it has been a worthy follow-up to Watchmen, which I never thought I would see, even though it's really not a Watchmen story.
Yeah,
it's really a DC Universe story.
I was about to say, like, the kind of pitch of it as a Watchmen follow-up, it's weird in that, because we do have some of the same characters who are making appearances, and there are definitely references to the events of Watchmen and things that are felt and some similarities in the storytelling structure. I don't even really regard this as a sequel to Watchmen at this point. This is a DC Universe story.
Yep.
It just happens to involve some characters from Watchmen who I think are being used again for metatextual reasons that I'm sure once the series wraps up, we will probably have a big, long breakdown of this and how it all, you know, it might be a good topic for an entire giant size unto itself.
Yeah, for those of us that have been reading it, absolutely, because it's a book that feels – it's like it's a Geoff Johns event book. It feels important, feels big. But before we move on, I do want to say also Gary Frank, who has always been an amazing artist, is putting in some of the best work, I would say even the best work of his career. And that's incredible given how high we were on his work in Batman Earth 1, for instance, that we reviewed on our show in the past. He is doing fantastic work here. Well, with that being said, we'll move on to watching. And before we get into the one CW show we have to discuss, I have now one episode left to watch of The Walking Dead for this season. David Sunday and I watched three consecutive episodes, I believe, this past weekend. And I'm going to make a controversial comment, Nick. I'm going to make a comment I wasn't prepared to make earlier this season.
Okay.
In the back half of the season, AMC has done the improbable. They have made The Walking Dead great again.
Okay.
They have. They just have. Todd told us.
It's not that I don't believe you and Todd and whoever else has watched it. It is – they didn't diminish my ability to care. They didn't wound my ability to care. They decapitated my ability to care. And put it on a pike and then split the rest of my body up into little pieces and disposed of them to the seven winds. There is no resurrecting this. It is gone. It is dead forever.
And yet, Walking Dead Month lives on, my friend.
Oh, yeah. Walking Dead Month lives on always because we're dedicated to our gimmicks. But in terms of me being an ongoing viewer of this show, no. It's over.
I will say I have not – now, they still might miss with the finale. I haven't watched the finale yet. It might suck because honestly, the episode I just watched felt like the finale. It was amazing, really, really great. And really, each of the episodes preceding it had been really great. But that one in particular had a very shocking ending, heart-wrenching ending, amazing acting from – some of the characters you would expect to have amazing acting, and really left me shaken in a way that the show has not left me, in a way that I feel like the Negan arc attempted to do but failed. So, excited to see where it goes from here. Now, let us move on to Legends of Tomorrow and its finale, season finale, wrapping up season 4, I believe.
Yeah, season 4
of DC's Legends of Tomorrow. A lot going on in this one. We get some classic Legends hijinks here. We get a James Taylor sing off at the end, a joint singing of a James Taylor song. We get John Constantine salvaging Ray's soul. We get a lot of stuff going on here, and I don't want to spoil everything for people that might not have watched the series yet. Nick, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this finale because
Sorry, I got distracted by something. Damn it! I do not read Big E's Twitter account while recording a podcast.
Well, now there's no way that I can't go to the Twitter machine and type in what handle is he going by now? I don't know.
At WWE Big E, but Florida Man.
Florida Man.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Let's see what we got here. We got a college. Oh my god. College age Jergens bottle in hand, would never believe we'd have this interaction. Who the hell is Tanya Tate?
Well,
adult actress. Oh,
yes, my. Yes. I was about to say, go out there to your Google machine and you'll.
Anyway,
she's a middle-aged white woman, which, stop me if you've heard this before. But Big E seems to have a taste, a certain preference for middle-aged white women.
He kind of explains it in the tweet right below that. My tweets are cries for help, but like, don't talk to me or touch me or interact with me, though. Help me, but leave me alone.
Yes.
And then the one before that is the Wilder Joshua money, and it's a gif of Danny DeVito burning dollar bills.
He's the best. He's the best. Oh, go a couple down. Go a couple down. Past the Kofi one, which, I mean, he has a serious tweet, which is a great tweet, but I'm talking about the next joke one. Every day I tackle existentialist questions. Am I happy? What is my purpose? Why do I keep running when someone shoots me into the ropes?
Which reminds me, Nick, that the people out there are listening to the longest running weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. Yep.
Anyway, Legends of Tomorrow.
I think reading Big E's Twitter account has just become a new recurring feature on the show, probably.
Legends of Finale
brings it. It's tomorrow. It's season 4 tomorrow.
I gotta say, Nick, I've been hesitant to talk about this episode.
I think I know what you're about to say.
I was really underwhelmed.
Yeah, I liked it, but I didn't like it to the degree that I have liked virtually every other episode of this season. Mm-hmm. I think it's the worst episode of the season. I say that without having clear memories of what each individual episode was.
I think it might be too.
Or maybe it's just the fact that my expectations built and built over the course of the season because of how they kept exceeding my expectations. So maybe they eventually, there was only so far you could take that. Right. But, and also, I don't want this new trope to be every season they kill off a cast member and then bring the cast member back just in a different format. Because they've already confirmed that the actress who plays Arya is coming back next season just as a different character, which is lame and silly.
I'm not interested. I'm not interested in a new Zari. They might win me over on her.
Yeah.
But right now, I liked Zari. Zari was my favorite character of this season.
They had
because
gotten,
of her arc she went
because
on.
She had grown and they got rid of her, which is silly.
It felt like a waste.
And I know our good friend Todd Weber has said, you know, if you're going to bring in new characters, why not bring in DC characters? And honestly, at this point, the show doesn't even really feel like a DC show anymore. I mean, it does in as much as it has some DC concepts, but it is not trying to adapt comic book stories. It is telling wholly original ones at this point, and I'm fine with it. The show has been better as a result.
Yeah, and we're not burying the show at all. The show's been great. But I'm pumped to get to season five.
Like, it's just the Charlie thing eventually worked this season, even though it took me a long time to get warmed up to it.
Agreed.
But just because it worked once doesn't mean I want to see it again.
You know? And it doesn't mean it needs to be a repetitive thing because and it's worked on The Flash with Harrison Wells, you know, getting a different Wells every season. But and every show doesn't need to have that. And the other aspect is this was definitely the worst finale since season one. Both the season two and season three finales went so big. I mean, there was nothing in this episode that matched the sheer insanity of Bebo, right?
Right.
There was no Bebo moment. They said their Bebo moment was the sing-off, but that just felt like a regular episode. It didn't feel like a finale. They just had an episode where they broke into a Bollywood musical. That felt like a Legends moment. This felt really oddly subdued, I thought, for a Legends of Tomorrow finale. And not that it was a bad episode. I mean, it was fine. I still enjoy these characters so much that I'll watch them do anything. I thought the effects were pretty good for the most part. The Constantine stuff in hell was great, but I don't know, man. I thought for such a good season that was sort of a bummer of a way to end things. I thought it was definitely below the Flash and Arrow finales.
I agree, and yet the tease of what the premise of next season is, yes.
As I saw Charles Manson on that list, I pictured you doing the Vince McMahon intrigue gif.
No, I did. They had me with like Caligula and Genghis Khan. I was doing the full Vince McMahon gif, the sit up, and then the Charles Manson one was the shocked face chair knocked over backwards.
And the chair going backwards.
Yeah, that was.
So what you're saying is that's good shit.
Yes.
Such good shit.
Such good shit.
That's great.
No, I'm pumped though. A Constantine seemingly focused season with this Astra character as the lead villain and all these different vile characters from throughout history. That sounds awesome. I'm for this.
Let's do it. So with that being said, I can't think of anything else I watched. What about you, Nick?
No, nothing.
Nothing. So with that being said, I am looking once again at the recently installed and oddly at odds with itself, or evenly at odds with itself, digital grandfather clock that I've had installed in the studio here. And it says there's a minute on there. So that can only mean one thing here at the old HTF Studios. That means that it's time for the Wrestling Minute.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot's happened since we last had a Wrestling Minute, Nick. A lot. But let's talk about the biggest thing that's happened since we last had a Wrestling Minute.
What's Double or Nothing?
AEW's Double or
Nothing.
Yeah,
it has been that long, hasn't it?
Yep. It finally came.
Fucking amazing.
Yep. We came, we saw, and it blew our doors off. We previewed it the last time we talked about this.
In brief, without getting into the minutiae of each individual match on the show,
right?
The promise of AEW that Cody, the Bucks, Tony Khan, anybody who has talked about the larger aims of the promotion has said from day one is that we are not seeking to be WWE's competitor. We are seeking to be their alternative. And to be fair, other companies have used that same line in the past and have lived that to a certain extent before eventually devolving into WWE Lite. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the way AEW goes. I don't know. As of right now, their promise of being the alternative, of providing us something that either A, we haven't seen before, B, we haven't seen before and didn't know that we wanted, or C, something that we used to have and didn't know how much we missed it until it was given back to us, this show provided that true alternative. Variety, something for everybody, and in some cases, a throwback to the way wrestling used to be.
Yep.
And I fucking loved this show. Is it like star rating wise or match quality wise one of the best shows I've ever seen? Probably not. But I tell you this, I can't recall a show that has made me as emotionally invested in this one as this one did by the end of the night. I felt like I was on a wrestling high that WWE never produces these days for me.
We called each other after the show and talked for about maybe 35 minutes afterwards about
the show.
And
this was at like midnight. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was exactly what you said. And you know what? The other thing that it brought back that we used to have and didn't know how much we missed, or at least in my case, didn't know how much I missed, was a feeling that it's okay if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by that is when you watch Raw in particular every week or even SmackDown, there's a feeling of homogeny and a feeling of a machine rolling along and a feeling that, God, if anything goes wrong, it will derail everything. That this thing, you know, everything has to be to the point. We have to know exactly when we're pitching to break. We have to know exactly when to look at the hard camera. We have to know every bump is so processed and so institutionalized with the way that WWE does things. This was more of that WCW feel of it's live. Shit's going to go wrong sometimes, and shit's going to go very, very right sometimes. And in this case, it was beautiful. They're going to be bad shows. No doubt they're going to have bad shows.
Absolutely.
It happens to every company. But the thing is, that's okay. No reasonable person expects a wrestling company to be nothing but great all the time. But what the difference is there's that feeling that it could be great. Mm-hmm. That in a given moment, yeah, they might have an issue with the commentary. They might have an issue with pitching to the next segment. They might have a timing issue. But it's okay.
And not just that. But like,
anything can happen.
And not just that, but the next show, Fyter Fest, whenever it comes. I genuinely have no idea what the style and structure of that show is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
WWE, even let's take them at their best right now, which is NXT TakeOver.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would all agree that the NXT TakeOvers kind of follow a similar formula to one another.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. They're great.
And AEW undoubtedly will develop a formula. I understand.
We don't know what it is.
But we don't know what it is. And so right now it feels unique and different. That matters for a lot.
It does. The variety, you mentioned the variety show aspect. Giving us three matches in a row as your main event.
As your co-main events.
That all felt different.
And how about a tag team match legitimately being presented as on the same level as your two most intense singles rivalries on that show?
Yep. And it's sort of that what wrestling used to be. WrestleMania 17, we always talk about, it's a variety show with different styles of matches. WrestleMania 19, same way. This is kind of what we have in this AEW product. We're allowing things to be different from one another. We don't need every match to have the same heat segment, to have the same timing on the comebacks. We don't need to know the exact structure of every single match and segment before it happens. There's a sense of controlled chaos to it that I miss in wrestling. And, it was exciting. It was very exciting. Some memorable matches, an all-time classic match in Cody and Dustin. So I'm super excited to see what happens going forward. And I got to say, to steal a phrase, I'm all in on AEW from this point.
Maybe you'll be so all in that you'll eventually get the names of their shows right in the future, as you struggled with on previous installments of the Wrestling Minute.
You are referring, of course, to the present non-existent show All or Nothing.
All or Nothing.
Which, in fairness,
double in, double out.
Maybe I've given them the name of their sequel to Double or Nothing next year. Maybe next year can be All or Nothing.
Maybe it can be. Oh, in any event. Also, we had an NXT TakeOver. I don't want to talk about Raw or SmackDown. NXT TakeOver, as they always are, outstanding. Great matches up and down the card. Street Profits with a career-making performance, in my view, as someone who doesn't watch weekly NXT TV, a career-making performance. And then also an outstanding NXT title match between Johnny Gargano and your new NXT champion, Adam Cole, baby.
And we haven't talked publicly about this, I don't think on either of our Twitter feeds or anything, but I actually think on first watch – I like this a little bit better than the 2 out of 3 falls.
I like this much better than the 2 out of 3 falls.
Personally. Was it the selling of the leg?
It was not the selling of the leg. It was the fact that 2 out of 3 falls matches can often stretch my suspension of disbelief. And I understand it's not real. I get that. I hate 2 out of 3 falls matches where moves that never finish actual matches will finish a fall. And then you get to the final fall and it's like, nothing finishes the match. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that last fall of Gargano and Cole, while it was awesome, why wasn't every other fall, like why weren't those characters fighting as hard for every other fall? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that always bugged me about it. This being one fall to a finish, and you know, Johnny Gargano not being able to kick out of literally everything under the sun, moves it up a bit in my eyes.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about the booking of Johnny Gargano's character. I don't think he's been booked well for the last year in NXT, which is saying a lot because he's so good and so over, and he's had more – he's legitimately at this probably got more – 4- and 5-star matches than anybody in company history.
We'll get shouted down by some of our Place to Be Nation pop compatriots, but I still think the heel turn was a stupid thing.
Totally agree.
Like,
waste of time.
Yeah, again, we don't watch the weekly TV. I'm sure it was fine, but I'm saying in the larger context of the story, Johnny Gargano as a heel doesn't make any fucking sense.
No, they took a guy that was in March of last year, the most over babyface wrestling it had in America since Daniel Bryan, and then a year later he's a heel. Weird, yep. But it worked out, and they had great matches, two great matches in a row, and I'm excited to see what happens in NXT going forward. A lot of interesting stories you can tell here. I think we both think that we're going to get an Undisputed Era implosion coming soon. That will lead to Roderick Strong and Adam Cole having some matches, which should be great.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a lot of stuff to follow here at NXT.
Absolutely.
Well, and with then, all
next week on the Wrestling Minute, we'll probably follow up with some thoughts on Super Showdown, which, as we all know, and as you, if you watched Raw this past week, learned is happening. Greg, this Friday, Brock Lesnar is threatening to cash in his Money in the Bank contract this Friday. That's right, Friday, folks. And so after seeing that segment on Raw Monday, I thought, what better way to get people hyped for Super Showdown, and what better way to get people hyped to hear our thoughts next week than to get you excited for Friday? So here, to perform the song, appropriately enough, Friday is WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. JR, take it away.
Well, folks, good old JR here, Jim Ross. Hope you're enjoying my new podcast, Grillin' JR, which, the boys were nice enough to let me shill here on your show. And Paul, there's just one thing that I want to tell you. Oh, yeah. 7 a.m., waking up in the morning. Gotta be fresh, gotta go downstairs. I got to have my bowl. My chocolate cake, if you know what I'm saying. Gotta have cereal. Seeing everything. Time is going. Ticking on and on, everybody's rushing. Gotta get down to the bus stop. Gotta catch my buzz. I see my friend, kicking in the front seat. Sitting in the back seat. Gotta make up my mind, which seat can I take? Well, it's Friday. Friday. Got to get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend. Friday, getting down on Friday. Everybody in this business is looking forward to the weekend. Partying. Yeah. Oh, you're partying. And that's the business's fault. I guess it is the fault of the wrestling business that you're partying. It is our fault. Not your fault, not your personal responsibility of what you're choosing to put in your body, but it's our fault that you chose to go out, get hammered, sleep with some floozy on the weekend, and then end up dead in a ditch somewhere. That's our fault. Fun. Looking forward to the weekend. 7:45, we're driving on the highway. Me and Vince McMahon in the car. He gives me that look, and I know he has just farted. Cruising so fast, I want time to fly. I want to get out of this car before my nostrils are burning. Fun. Think about fun. That's the only thing I can do to get my mind off of it. You know what it is. I got this. You got this. My friend is by my right eye. I got this. You got this. Now you know it. Kick it in the front seat. Sit in the back seat. I gotta make my mind up right now. Do I sell it or not? Do I sell the fart or not? Which seat can I take? It's Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend. Friday. Getting down on Friday. Everybody is looking their asses forward to the weekend. Partying. It's all fun and games until McMahon farts in your general direction. I made a decision right there on the weekend not to sell. Yesterday was Thursday. Today it is Friday. I apologize, folks. I lost my train of thought there for a moment at these brilliant lyrics here. We so excited. We're gonna have a ball today. Tomorrow is Saturday. And of course, Sunday comes after Saturday, but before Monday. I want to be clear about that. I don't want this weekend to end. Sunday night is when Austin defends the title against The Rock. Two pretty decent hands, fair hands. I wonder who signed him, by the way. He signed him on Friday. Friday. I've got to get my ass down on Friday. Everybody is looking forward to the weekend. Friday, getting down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend, partying. Yeah, party. Oh, you're partying again. That's real cute. Yeah, that's, Gino Hernandez partied a lot too. Anyway, everybody's looking forward to the weekend. Weekend, getting down, Friday, the weekend. You get the picture, folks. We're looking forward to it's Friday.
Our traveling fanboys.